Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, October 20th, 2017, so I have been told. This is our second study session on Neil Postman's Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk, and What to Do About It. We're picking up today on Chapter 5. This is content. It's on from my book. It's page 53. There are scanned pages available if you want to follow along, like with a hard copy as we proceed through the book. This book is not in print, so it might be more difficult for people to find. I think that this book has some significant information, important constructive info that deals with how to use words, paying attention to the use of words with regards to how incorrect use of words can create problems, cause conflict, confusion. Really important info. We heard Mr. Fuller at the very beginning of the program. He highlights word use and paying attention to word use as a key part of what counter-racism is about, that a major aspect of racism, white supremacy, is incorrect use of words, often the deliberate and deceptive use of words. And I think this book gives a lot of insight into paying attention and being mindful about that sort of thing. Also, you should pay attention to the very first person who is mentioned in light of all of the controversy that is going on as we read this book with Harvey Weinstein and everything else. Just keep that in mind right from the starting gate. We will begin. Neil Postman, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, narrated by one of our Cows listeners, Mel, doing a great job. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Content. In Woody Allen's book, Getting Even, he gives us a rundown on some of the key men in the mafia, one of whom is named Albert the Logical Positivist Carrillo. What makes this funny, of course, is Woody's mixing of two worlds of discourse, which may be in the same universe, but are light years away from each other. The joke is roughly the same, but not as funny, as the one we encounter in the Elizabeth Barrett Browning poem, which she begins with, "How do I love thee?" and then, her pocket calculator at the ready, proceeds to, "Let me count the ways." Perhaps the poem was intended to be read at a convention of public accountants. Every semantic environment is recognizable not only by its tone and role structure, but by the words it uses and the special ways in which it uses them. My purpose here is to indicate some of the important rules which define the content of semantic environments. The first of these is that every semantic environment has a technical vocabulary. In politics, law, religion, war, commerce, science, sports, in whatever system of human enterprise we can isolate, there are certain words which form the core of the content of the subject. Some of these are so specialized or technical that they never appear in any semantic environment other than the one which has given them life, and to which they, in turn, give life. For example, if the phrase Planck's constant comes out of someone's mouth, let us say twice in the span of 5 minutes, we can be fairly sure that physics is the subject she's discussing. Or, suppose you are in a restaurant and, over the hubbub, you become aware of a discussion at the next table. You miss most of what is being said, but you catch the phrases rules of evidence, statute of limitations, hung jury, and civil tort. You know, of course, that the subject is not quantum physics, which is fine, since lawyers don't know anything about that. What I'm saying here is nothing more than that each semantic environment has a characteristic technical vocabulary which distinguishes it from any other. But there is more to say about this than you might think. For example, contrary to what many people believe, the words which comprise a semantic environment are not so much about a subject as they are the subject itself. Subtract all the words that are used in discussing physics or law or theology, and you have just about subtracted the subject altogether. If there is nothing to talk with, there is nothing to talk about. Of course, you can invent new words to take the place of old ones, but until you do so, you have a world of things, not meanings. In fact, it is only a small exaggeration to say that all knowledge is language. History, for example, is not just events. It is a way of talking about past events. And astronomy is not stars and planets, but a particular way of talking about them. The sentence, "the moon is beautiful," is not astronomy, but the sentence, "the moon influences the tides," is. There is an old joke about a mother who is boasting to a neighbor of her son's academic achievements. To prove how smart he is, the mother calls him into the room and says, "Harold, say something in geometry for Mrs. Green." Now, the point of this joke is supposed to be that, in thinking one can say something in geometry, the mother demonstrated her own ignorance, not her son's brilliance. But in fact, there is no point to the joke, since Harold could say something in geometry, and quite easily, like, "the whole is equal to the sum of its parts," which, incidentally, is a true statement in geometry, but false just about every place else. Words are not only tools to think with, they are, for all practical purposes, the content of our thoughts. As Ludwig, the logical positivist Wittgenstein, put it, language is not only the vehicle of thought, it is also the driver. In putting forward this idea, I am not implying, nor did Wittgenstein, that the world consists only of words. I am saying, however, that what meanings we give to the world, what sense we make of things, derive from our power to name, to create vocabularies. The process by which words and other symbols give shape and substance to our thoughts can be suggested by your trying to multiply 495 by 384. Except, in this instance, you must only use Roman numerals. I think you will find the operation quite impossible to do. Without access to the symbol O and a system of positional notation, the answer is literally inconceivable, i.e. you cannot think it. Perhaps more to the point, try to describe to another person what goes on in the place we call school, but without using such terms as school, teacher, student, principal, test, grades, subject, course, curriculum, syllabus, homework, or any of the more or less technical terms which compromise the vocabulary of that semantic environment. I do not say that it cannot be done, but my guess is that what you will end up describing will be barely recognizable as a school. Perhaps it will sound like a prison, or a hospital, or a rehabilitation center. It depends, and it depends on what words you use in place of those you have given up. One more example. Consider the two vocabularies that are commonly used to describe drug use. One of them you will hear every 15 minutes or so on television. "Mother," shouts an irate young woman, "I can do it myself." What's wrong with her? She is upset. Her nerves are jangled. She is not feeling well. She can't go on with her work. The recommended solution is to take a drug, aspirin, Bufrin, tranquilizers, Nitol, etc. The language here is the language of illness and medical care, and on that account, I assume, the narcotics agent pay it no attention. But what the audience is being advised to take can also be called uppers or downers. We are being asked to turn off and turn on, to get high. These terms are, of course, part of the language of the streets. Well, which is it? Are we restoring equanimity to our troubled lives, or are we blowing our minds? It depends, doesn't it, on what you call it and why. This is why, in discussing what words we shall use in describing an event, we are not engaging in mere semantics. We are engaged in trying to control the perceptions and responses of others, as well as ourselves, to the character of the event itself. And that is why people who understand this fact wince when someone gets ready to tell it like it is. No one can tell anything like it is. In the first place, it isn't anything until someone names it. In the second place, the way in which it is named reveals not the way it is, but how the namer wishes to see it, or how he is capable of seeing it. And third, how it has been named becomes the reality for the namer, and all who accept the name, but it need not be our reality. Take, for example, the type of man who is conventionally called a priest. If you accept this name, you will not think him insane for deliberately abstaining from sexual intercourse for his entire lifetime. If you do not accept this name, you will think such a man... If you do not accept this name, you will think such a man is badly in need of psychiatric help. By accepting the name, I mean that you agree to its legitimacy, that you judge the semantic environment within which it occurs to be reasonable and purposeful. Above all, you accept the assumptions upon which it rests. Well, what shall we say, then, of a priest? How can we tell it like it really is? Is he displaying psychotic symptoms, or is he displaying his devotions to God? The point is well made in the story of the three umpires. The first umpire, being a man of small knowledge of how meanings are made, says, "I calls 'em as I sees 'em." I calls them as they are. The second umpire, knowing something about human perception and its limitation, says, I calls them as I sees them. The third umpire, having studied at Cambridge with Wittgenstein himself, says, until I calls them, they ain't. This does not mean, of course, that some umpires are not better than others. What you call something tells a great deal about how well and how widely you can see. After all, the umpire who calls it strike three, when everyone else sees a pitch sail over the batter's head, is usually called blind. It still counts as strike three, however. J. Edgar Hoover may have named left turns, and Martin Luther King as well, his nemesis, but the rest of us are not obliged to accept his labels. And so, we have two matters to consider here. The first is a principle. The vocabulary of any semantic environment defines the reality with which the environment is concerned. The second is a question. How do we know when to accept or reject that vocabulary? As I am writing this chapter, a controversy is raging over whether or not the CIA has been implicated in political assassinations. The words implicated in political assassinations are not my words. They are the ones that the president and other responsible officials have used to talk about the subject, and therefore make it into the subject. So far as I know, no one in public office has asked if the CIA put out a contract on Fidel Castro, and if it did, who the hit man was. This is the vocabulary of Albert, the logical positivist, Carrillo, and of course makes it, i.e. attempts to terminate the lives of certain men, a different subject. To assassinate suggests entirely different motivations and a completely different context from putting out a contract on. In fact, the President of the United States, 1975, has forthrightly stated that it is not the policy of his administration to assassinate. In other words, assassination is not a crime, it is a policy, which you may pursue or not, according to your needs. There would be no problem here, no question of stupid or crazy talk, if not for people like George Orwell, who stand on the side and whisper troublesome words in our ears. For example, quote, political language is designed to make lies sound truthful and murder respectable, unquote. Or, as an example of how such language deceives, written about the Spanish Civil War almost a quarter of a century before Vietnam, quote, defenseless villages are bombarded from the air, the inhabitants driven out into the countryside, the cattle machine-gunned, the huts set on fire with incendiary bullets. This is called pacification. Millions of peasants are robbed of their farms and sent trudging along the roads with no more than they can carry. This is called transfer of population, or rectification of frontiers, unquote. Of course, I am not saying that Orwell, in accusing political leaders of murder, is telling it like it is. He is telling it like he wants us to see it. And he wants us to see it that way because he regarded politics as a branch of moral philosophy. To Orwell, political language was doing what it is supposed to do when it revealed to people the moral implications of their actions. Even in cases where he participated in war, as in the Spanish Civil War, or gave his support to war, as in World War II, he refused to use words which would depersonalize the enemy or make war appear less than a brutal suspension of moral codes. Political language, he concluded, is largely a defense of the indefensible. But how shall we know if Orwell's way of seeing it is right or wrong? I wish there was an easy answer to this, but there isn't. There is, however, another principle, a rule, if you will, that is helpful. I said a while back that what you call something depends on how well and widely you see. What I mean by that is that some people get locked into the vocabulary of a subject. By locked in, I mean that they have so deeply internalized the words conventionally used to describe something that they seem unable even to imagine a different set of words being applied to the situation. Their perceptions are completely controlled by someone else's vocabulary. Such people are, then, at the mercy of someone else's names, and at the mercy of the purposes that such names imply. Thus, the principle is that the more flexible you are in conceiving alternative names for things, the better will you be able to control your responses to situations. Make no mistakes about it. The vocabulary of a semantic environment plays a critical role in setting the rules of response. If the president can get you to say, with him, that his administration's policy toward assassination is such and such, then the such and such doesn't matter. You are in the same semantic environment as he, and the rest is merely commentary. This principle does not imply that the vocabulary of every semantic environment is suspect. Some vocabularies are, and some are not. The questions we need to ask are, what is the nature of the reality these words create? What sort of response do these words require of me? Does this response serve purposes with which I agree? To Orwell, the language of politics ceased to serve any reasonable and humane purpose, and, as a consequence, he spent much of his time attacking its words and calling attention to the peculiar kinds of responses they required. But one does not need to go as far as Orwell to see that it is necessary to approach the vocabulary of certain systems with a full measure of skepticism. Such skepticism may profitably be displayed toward three aspects of the vocabulary of a semantic environment. The first I have already mentioned, and that is the technical or specialized words of a system. A much more troublesome aspect of the vocabulary of a semantic environment is what I shall call its key words. By this, I mean those simple, non-technical words which appear in every semantic environment, but whose meanings shift as the words pass from one context to another. For example, it is not likely that you will have difficulty, if you are curious, in discovering the meaning of such terms as Planck's constant, or statute of limitations, or extreme unction, or ethno-methodological. These are technical terms, whose range of meaning is narrow, and whose association with a particular universe of discourse is well fixed. But what of such words as true, false, right, wrong, law, progress, good, bad? Their potential for mischief is exceedingly great, precisely because they do not appear to be technical terms, or hard words. And they are not used in every system. The word law, for example, comes up in science, as in Newton's law, in government, as in the law of the land, in religion, as in God's law, in economics, as in the law of supply and demand, and in the home, as in laying down the law. In each system, the meaning of law is quite special, and it is likely to confuse us unless we pay considerable attention to the assumptions on which the word rests. Let us take a common example, the word true. What is a true statement in science, and how is it different from a true statement in politics, or in literature, or in law, or in religion? And what of progress? Does a nation progress? And if it does, how is its progress different from progress in education, or sports, or science, or philosophy? Or, let us take one of the hardest words of all, good. What is good for General Motors, Charles Wilson once says, is good for America. Maybe so, but we would first have to know what good means in both parts of the sentence, and the meaning of each is buried deep in the soil of the semantic environment it comes from. The first good comes from the world of business, and we can assume it refers to conditions which permit General Motors to increase its profits. But what does America increase by such conditions? Jobs, perhaps, but not necessarily. Air pollution, certainly. Better automobiles, perhaps, but not necessarily in what would better mean. More traffic jams, probably. In considering Mr. Wilson's proposition, we may wonder if there is any sense in which it can be said that something is good for America. Who's America? And which Americans? And how do we determine in which sense something is good? For it or them? And how do we determine in what sense something is good for it or them? In fact, one might even ask the same sort of question of General Motors. What is good for General Motors, as viewed from the perspective of the United Auto Workers, does not always coincide, as you may have noticed, with the meaning of good as understood by the chairman of the board. But to come back to America for a moment, it is, naturally, a key word in many different semantic environments. The Olympics is America's chance to show what it is made of, I heard a television announcer say recently. 10 minutes later, on another station, a preacher said, "There is a crisis of faith in America." Later that evening, an educator, "For all its faults, education in America is still the best." What aspect of America did each have in mind? Were they talking about particular Americans or America in the abstract? And what sort of evidence, if any, did each use as the basis of the statement? In each of these cases, I might add, it wouldn't surprise me if the audience was able to grasp the general sense in which the word was used. But how would any audience construe the term un-American? A House Committee on Treasonous Activities makes sense, even if unwarranted. A Committee on Unpopular Opinions also makes sense, even if more unwarranted. But a House Committee on Un-American Activities? What could this mean? This term surely must be one of the more curious and revealing words in the semantic environment of politics. It suggests, to me at least, a religious aspect to citizenship, as if, in being an American citizen, one is committed to doctrines that are unknown, or at least unaccepted, outside our borders. I confess that, if there are such doctrines, they have escaped my notice, so the term un-American remains a puzzle to me. But the main point here is not what puzzles or doesn't puzzle me, but how such seemingly simple, everyday words can generate such confusion. A third aspect of the content of a semantic environment which requires our attention, and Orwellian skepticism, is what we may call its metaphors. Metaphor includes both technical terms and keywords, but may be distinguished by the fact that it imposes a precise kind of imagery, or point of view on a subject or situation. For example, when I talk about the process of communication, I tend to imagine it, as you know by now, as a biological process. And that is why I use such terms as soil, environment, growth, pollution. Those who imagine communication as a mechanical process will use such terms as input, output, sender, receiver, and channel. Each semantic environment is characterized by tendencies toward certain metaphorical constructions of reality. This is quite inevitable, but it also tends to be overlooked by those in the environment, and on that account can be quite dangerous. For example, when Walt Disney made his nature films, he quite explicitly anthropomorphized animals, that is, invested them with human qualities and motives. Most people have been quite aware of this, and I don't suppose that even the most devoted Disneyite is likely to expect that a deer or an otter, in spite of Disney's attributions, will enjoy playing cards or going skiing for a weekend. But, as Arthur Koestler has been trying to point out for years, most people are quite unaware of the opposite tendency in the work of many scientists, particularly behavioral psychologists. He calls this tendency ratomorphic. That is, a strong inclination to view the behavior of animals as the fundamental analog of the behavior of human beings. In the anthropomorphic view of nature, animals are held to act like men. In the ratomorphic view, men are held to act like animals. Rats are one of the more popular animals used, but pigeons, B.F. Skinner, geese, Conrad Lorenz, and apes, Desmond Morris, have also been used as a basis for telling us what we are really like. There is usually no problem here as long as one is aware that an analogy has been drawn, but frequently, workers in a certain field of activity, or just plain people in ordinary situations, allow their metaphors through passion, forgetfulness, or ignorance to get the better of them. Their perceptions get locked into a particular way of construing what is happening. Among several reasons why the women's liberation movement, an interesting metaphor in itself, runs into resistance is that both men and women have internalized a rich lexicon of metaphors about the subjects of sex, love, and domesticity. A man's home is his castle, for example. Well, that makes him the king, doesn't it? And she, of course, is the queen. And kings beat queens, not only in kingdoms, but in poker as well. And in chess, queens sacrifice themselves for kings, which is the proper thing to do. Or how about a working mother, which rather suggests that the act of mothering is not work, while, for example, the act of waitressing is? Or how about not tying your children to your apron strings? Fathers are just as likely to do this as mothers, but since fathers are not apt to wear aprons, on whom does the onus fall? And how about housewife itself? This may not exactly imply that a woman marries a house, but it does suggest rather pointedly where she belongs. Or what about the miss in Miss Jones? What exactly is Jones missing? And who wears the pants in your family anyway? The movement is quite correct in challenging the validity of these metaphors, especially because metaphors are apt to be so unobtrusively potent in giving direction to our attitudes. One might say that every political, scientific, social, religious, or economic movement represents an attack upon a prevailing set of metaphors, an established way of constructing reality. The divine right of kings was, after all, a metaphor which explained and justified a certain power relationship in government. Locke challenged the metaphor, Tom Paine ridiculed it, and Jefferson buried it, where it remained until Nixon almost restored it. In science, such a process of metaphor challenge is commonplace. Classical physics, for example, relies heavily on the imagery of a billiard game. Its concepts of force, velocity, and position rest on the idea that atoms behave pretty much the way billiard balls do, the ballomorphic view of the universe. Einstein, Bohr, and Heisenberg were the Locke, Paine, and Jefferson of the physical world. They exposed the limitations of the metaphor. The field of medicine, as Carl Menninger has been trying to teach us, relies to a considerable extent on the idea that disease is an alien force that attacks or invades human beings. While he concedes that some diseases are best described this way, for example smallpox, there are many others which apparently require a different metaphor altogether. For instance, do we really catch a cold or do we manufacture it? Do we contract TB or concoct it? In the instance of ulcers, most of us are prepared to believe that we do not catch it, we produce it. But what of arthritis, cancer, rheumatism? The search for cures will depend, in a large extent, on our finding new and illuminating metaphors. This is certainly the case in the field of psychiatry, where the prevailing metaphors have been under severe attack in recent years, most notably by Thomas Shaws and R.D. Lang. Is curious, bothersome, self-destructive behavior a disease, a mental illness, like physical illness, or are mentally disturbed people visionaries? I do not wish to imply that the metaphorical biases of every semantic environment are destructive, only that they are apt to be hard to see and therefore require close scrutiny. Scientists who refer to people as subjects, businessmen who refer to people as personnel, teachers who refer to people as culturally disadvantaged, are not merely describing, they are committing themselves to a point of view, one of which they may only be dimly aware. Years ago, I knew a man who owned a children's camp for which the season's fee was $500. The man referred to each of the campers as my little half a G. In this instance, he knew quite well what his metaphor implied and rather reveled in it. It remains for me to say that no area of knowledge or social situation can exist without the support of metaphor. You will understand why if you look again at the sentence before this one. Why do I say knowledge is an area? Well, I could call it a body, which suggests that it gets born, grows, and dies. Or I could call it a realm, which suggests that it has princes and peasants. But I will have to call it something, and that something must be drawn from my previous experience with the world around me. Simply, we think in metaphors. The question is, as Lewis Carroll stated, who shall be the master? Another principle governing the content of semantic environments is the type of sentence we expect from them. Each environment is characterized by certain types of sentences. In science, for example, we expect to find sentences that are mostly descriptive, predictive, and explanatory. In religion, we get sentences that are mostly prescriptive and judgmental. Their function is to tell us what we ought to do and what we may think of ourselves if we do not do what we ought. In advertising, we find sentences that are also prescriptive and judgmental, although occasionally, and usually against the will of advertisers, a descriptive statement will be found. For example, the Surgeon General has determined that cigarette smoking is dangerous to your health. In a courtroom, a witness is required to confine himself to descriptive statements. Please keep your conclusions to yourself, Mr. Harris, and just tell the court what you saw. The judge is largely prescriptive. I won't have any noise in this courtroom. The jury, mostly evaluative, we find the defendant, Mr. K, guilty. And our greatest lawyers, example Clarence Darrow, have always specialized in impressive explanatory sentences. Mr. K committed this crime, but we are all guilty for having been indifferent to the suffering that society has inflicted upon him. I am, of course, oversimplifying the matter, since in most situations, including the courtroom, you will find a rich mixture of all kinds of sentences, representing the fullest range of reasons why people talk. To inform, to predict, to explain, to control, to find out, to judge, to persuade, and so on. These are not mutually exclusive. You can explain in order to control, or predict in order to persuade, or inform in order to judge. Even in a scientific environment, which is apt to be more rigorous than others in the kind of sentences it will permit, you will find instances of, for example, highly prescriptive statements. Lysenko provides a notorious illustration of a scientist believing that something is the case because he believed it ought to be the case. But the point is that while no semantic environment I can think of is confined to one or two types of sentences, there is usually an emphasis on certain types as against others. Astrology, as I have already explained, looks to me more like religion than science, because the function of most of its sentences appears to be prescriptive rather than predictive. Religion, for its part, has had its craziest moments when it has tried to provide scientific descriptions of nature. It is exceedingly difficult to house both descriptions and a prescription in the same environment, as Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler found out. One function is likely to pollute the other. In some environments, of course, the question of what function of language shall predominate is highly controversial. In education, for example, arguments will frequently arise over whether teachers and textbooks should mainly prescribe and evaluate or mainly describe and explain. I used to have a firm opinion on this matter, favoring description and explanation, but I am no longer so sure. In any case, there are two final points to be made about the types of sentences which compromise a semantic environment. The first is that when you have a situation where two seemingly different environments are dominated by virtually the same types of sentences, you had better look again to see if they are so different after all. For example, both religion and advertising almost wholly consist of prescriptive, that is what you should do, and evaluative, this is good and that is bad, statements. One may well wonder, then, if the purposes of these environments are more similar than different. Indeed, Billy Graham has packaged his message in a way not unlike that in which Scope packages its message. In saying this, I am not sure if I am denigrating religion or elevating advertising. The point is, the types of sentences we come across in each environment give us information about the purposes of the environment, and sometimes surprising information. Second, it should be noted here that the function of sentences influences both their tone and their level of abstraction. Descriptive sentences, for example, tend to be cold and specific. Evaluative sentences, emotional and general. When we require a simple description, such as an answer to the question, "How do I get to Route so-and-so from here?" we do not expect an answer such as, "To get from here to there is like any journey of the soul, in which your character will be tested many times before you achieve tranquility." Neither do we wish to hear a lecture on how and why means are more important than ends. There is a time for specificity and a time for abstractions, and a great deal of nonsense is generated by people who do not know what time it is. And speaking of that, it is time for me to say what I mean by both crazy talk and stupid talk. Crazy talk, stupid talk. In the making of experts, there seems to be no end, to the unmaking as well. When they disagree, as in economics, there is confusion. When they agree, as in Vietnam, there is disaster. America, it sometimes appears, is dying from experts, but some of them have some breath to their vision. And though their proposals are often grandiose, they are nonetheless interesting. Language experts, however, are apt to be obsessed with trivialities. For instance, I have before me some of the opinions of 136 such experts, distinguished literary figures, commentators, and language experts, according to the editors of the Harper Dictionary of Contemporary Usage. They were asked to express their views on whether certain words and sentences were right or wrong. In most cases, no context was provided for the words and sentences, so that the questions amounted to asking what their opinions are of the letters T, F, and G. It is as if someone had asked you, what is your opinion of being handed a $5 bill? Even if you were an expert in international currency, you would be obliged to point out that this is a fairly empty question, and that everything would depend on the circumstances. If you had asked for change for a tent, one $5 bill would not be very satisfactory. But if you were broke, it might be breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Apparently, the absence of a semantic context did not greatly trouble these experts, and off they went. May author be a verb? Was one of the questions. Herman Wook, who authored such classics as Marjorie Morningstar, said, no, 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 no. What do you suppose he would have said to the question, may one use 8 no's in a row? Another question was whether or not the experts approved of critique as a transitive verb, as in, the editor critiqued the college newspaper. Michael J. Arlen said, it sounds stupid. Since I greatly admire Arlen's work, I hope that his it referred to the question itself, but from the context, I was forced to conclude otherwise. To the same question, Mr. Wook, who apparently used up all his best words in writing Marjorie Morningstar, said, yeech. To the question, may alibi be used for any kind of excuse? Anthony Burgess replied, alibi means somewhere else to me. It can't mean one thing in Latin and law and another thing in non-legal English. Mr. Burgess did not explain why a word can't mean one thing in one context and something else in another. He also apparently had not heard many Americans give alibis. Perhaps he had been somewhere else. But I would have gladly foregone his explanation of where he has been, if he had explained the sense in which we are to construe his can't. Are we talking about violations of natural law, or social custom, or national pride, or is it just Burgess law? Most of these experts carried on in this trivial way, indicating their personal feelings about certain words as words. I hate $5 bills. The letter G is an abomination. Ain't is ugly, etc. But a few of them gave replies of some social significance. For example, Leon Edel, a professor at New York University, to the question, how about highway signs reading go slow instead of slowly? Professor Edel replied, slowly would distract the illiterate. Now, there are several things about this answer that are worth commenting on. In the first place, it is possibly illogical. If one takes illiterate to mean unable to read, then to illiterate what's the sign said. Second, his reply is possibly ignorant. If Edel means by the illiterate people, who, let us say, prefer Jacqueline Suzanne to Henry James, and if he thinks that such people would be any more distracted by Lee than he, then we can conclude he simply doesn't know what he's talking about. But third, and most important, Edel's remark, which is very unusual for a professor from New York University. But third, and most important, Edel's remark, as illogical or ignorant, choose one, as it may be, is nonetheless one of a few opinions given by the experts which try to comment on the purpose and effect of this or any other sentence. He seems to have grasped the idea that the purpose of a road sign is to get people to do something, that it is important for them to do it, and that it is bad if they are distracted for some reason from doing it. Thus, with Professor Edel's unwitting help, we can locate the two central issues to consider in applying the names crazy talk and stupid talk. The first has to do with the purposes of a semantic environment, and therefore concerns values. The second has to do with the effects or consequences of people's language, and therefore is a matter of fact. Crazy talk and stupid talk are names we may give to certain remarks whose usefulness we wish to call into question. And when we ask ourselves, what is it about such remarks that is worth challenging, the answer is something like this. Two major sources of trouble in human affairs are, first, that people use language for bad, inhumane, unattainable purposes. And second, people use language ineffectively in trying to achieve good purposes. We are not talking in this book about words and sentences. We are talking about what they are for and how well they do what they are for. So far, wherever I have used the term crazy talk, I have been referring to talk that reflects bad purposes. Where I have used the term stupid talk, I have been referring to talk that defeats legitimate purposes.
Now, I will not say that this taxonomy is especially rigorous. It certainly has the potential for confusion, especially since it is so difficult to say what are the purposes of a situation, let alone whether they are good or bad. But, after all, when you consider that a whale is not classified as a fish, which it certainly looks like, and a tomato is not classified as a vegetable, which it certainly is used as, you must concede that any attempt to classify anything poses difficulties. In this case, my distinction between crazy talk and stupid talk is no less precise or more troublesome than a psychiatrist's distinction between a manic depressive and a schizophrenic. And I bother to make the distinction for the same reason. It helps in pointing the way to a solution to the problem. If we can see, even dimly, the way in which some person or situation is not working, then we are better equipped to suggest remedies. Here, I want to remind you, again, that in using the terms crazy talk and stupid talk, I am not saying that people are crazy or stupid. I am talking about language, which, in particular situations, does not achieve or cannot achieve reasonable or humane purposes, either because the purpose is unreasonable and inhumane, or the language will not do what it is supposed to do. Let us take as a first example, then, the matter which Professor Edel has called to our attention. I place it here because, frankly, it is simple and will give a clear picture of the difference between crazy and stupid talk. To begin with, I think I may say without fear of contradiction that the purpose of road signs is to inform the drivers of highway regulations. I will go further and say that this is a perfectly legitimate purpose. I cannot prove that it is, since statements of value cannot be proven, but I can say that efforts to increase the prospects of human survival almost always seem desirable to me, and not only to me, but to many people throughout the world. I am aware, of course, that not all people agree with this proposition, even in relation to the highways I have seen, for example, the work of vandals, who have painted a 3 into an 8, so that the road sign will say, speed limit 85 miles. This is what I call crazy talk, since its conscious purpose is to increase rather than diminish accidents. Stupid talk is a rather different matter. Let us assume that the State Highway Department, for example, in Connecticut, is committed to human survival. We can then assume that its road signs will be exclusively devoted to that end, and that the words which comprise them will be clear to the great majority of drivers. Professor Edel is surely wrong in believing that illiterates, Jacqueline Suzanne variety, would be distracted by go slowly. But I do know several drivers who have been distracted by no crossing the median divider, which is a favorite of someone in the Connecticut State Highway Department. The phrase median divider is a good example of stupid talk, since it has the potential to confuse at least some drivers, maybe even readers of Henry James, and therefore defeats the basic purpose of a sign. As you know, the language of road signs is almost entirely dominated by prescriptive sentences, such as go slowly, no left turn, stop here, hitchhiking prohibited. I have sometimes thought that this type of sentence might be the cause of some resentment on the part of drivers who, whether on the road of life or road to Danbury, do not fancy being given orders. It has crossed my mind that compliance might be more easily effected if highway regulations were stated in the form of predictive statements, such as, if you exceed 50 miles per hour and are observed doing this by a state trooper, the chances are great that you will be given a speeding ticket. I think Professor Edel would like that statement, and so would I, since its tone is more suitable to the kind of relationship government ought to have with citizens. But at 50 miles per hour, it would certainly be hard to read, and at 70, just about impossible. In any case, the semantic environment of road signs rarely, if ever, produces crazy talk, since just about everyone grants the legitimacy of its purpose. If we are to have problems in this environment, they will come from stupid talk, such as the suggestion I made in the last paragraph. Our next example, however, presents a somewhat different situation. The language in question is as follows. Nothing terrible is going to happen to you. All you have to do is to breathe in deeply. That strengthens the lungs. Inhaling is a means of preventing infectious diseases. Sounds like Marcus Welby giving assurance to a TB patient, doesn't it? The next sentences will tell you that it isn't. The men will have to work building houses and roads, but the women won't be obliged to do so. They'll do housework or help in the kitchen. The question for experts is, can but be used as the first word of a sentence? This little specimen of human language is the greeting given by an SS man to a train load of Jews who had arrived at the gas chamber complex at Belzee in August 1942. There's nothing stupid about this language, since it was generally effective in reducing the possibility of a desperate rebellion by the new arrivals. It is, however, crazy talk, because of the context in which it occurred. It was part of a pervasive semantic environment whose strategy was to make genocide appear reasonable. A similar example of this is found in a remark made by Paul Blobel, who was responsible for the massacre of 30,000 Jews and Russians at Babi Yar, near Kiev. Blobel, incidentally, was a university graduate of delicate sensibilities. Grammarians and other guardians of the purity of language will be pleased to know he had, in his small way, a commitment to their cause. Nonetheless, in explaining at Nuremberg what happened at Babi Yar, he said, "Human life was not as valuable to them, i.e. the Russians and Jews, as to us. Our men who took part in these executions suffered more than those who had to be shot." It is fairly certain that Blobel believed this, as did many others, but to get men to speak such sentences, you must first create a context in which language itself has got loose from its mooring, a context in which language no longer connects with rational purposes. The question of effectiveness of such language is irrelevant. One might even say that the sentence asserting that those behind the rifles are suffering more than those in front is a brilliant one, if your purpose is to persuade yourself and others that you are not wantonly insane. Talk is stupid when it does not work. Talk is crazy when, in working, it creates and sustains an irrational purpose. These two examples were chosen largely because they so easily demonstrate the distinction I am trying to make. But here is one that is somewhat more complicated. You will remember that Gordon Cooper was an astronaut, shot up above buildings and into outer space. During his 17th orbit around the Earth, he was moved to say a prayer. It is as follows. "I would like to take this time to say a little prayer for all people, including myself, involved in this launch operation. Father, thank you, especially for letting me fly this flight. Thank you for the privilege of being able to be in this position, to be up in this wondrous place, seeing all these many startling, wonderful things that you have created. Help guide and direct all of us, that we may shape our lives to be much better Christians trying to help one another, and to work with one another rather than fighting and bickering. Help us to complete this mission successfully. Help us in our future space endeavors that we may show the world that a democracy really can compete and still are able to do things in a big way, and are able to do research, development, and can conduct many scientific and very technical programs. Be with all our families. Give them guidance, encouragement, and let them know that everything will be okay. We ask in thy name. Amen." I will, of course, ignore Cooper's grammatical errors and other trivial improprieties, since they have no bearing on what is important here, and because even Hermann Wook might get a little dizzy and slip a bit on his 17th orbit around the Earth. What is important in judging the character of Cooper's language is the function of prayer and how Cooper performs it. People pray, of course, for many reasons, but I think it fair to say that the principal motive is to give form and substance to the belief that there is a transcendent purpose to life, embodied in a concept or deity which has dominion over all things. Through prayer, people put their ambitions, successes, failures, and tragedies in perspective. They humble themselves before greater powers and, by doing so, frequently find themselves uplifted and stronger. Again, I cannot prove it, but this seems to me a worthwhile purpose, and is, at least, widely practiced by civilized people all over the world. Cooper, then, is not doing anything that could be judged to be unreasonable or harmful. This does not appear to be crazy talk. Moreover, there is, at least for me, a certain charm, if not poignancy, in the fact that Cooper elected at that moment to say a prayer, as if he meant to imply that, though the Tower of Babel be built, men still know they are only men and not gods. And yet, it seems to me that this is one of the stupidest prayers I have ever heard. It is so stupid, in fact, that its purpose is more than defeated or compromised. It is completely transformed, and as a consequence, we may have here a case of stupid and crazy talk at the same time. To begin with, if you look again at his prayer, you will see a curious contradiction between its tone and its content. Its attitude and its role structure are clearly recognizable as those of prayer, with the exception of the first sentence, in which he announces what he is going to do and whom he is going to do it for. Every sentence begins basically with either a thank you or a request for help. He is, in other words, a supplicant, which is the role and tone always employed in a prayer. But when you try to identify the subject of Cooper's supplication, that is, who would be interested in helping with the problems he mentions, the alternatives that come to mind are curious. The first is the Secretary of Defense, who would certainly be more interested than any god I have ever heard in how America makes out in its space endeavors. Another might be professors of political theory, who might be interested in whether or not a democracy can compete, for example, with totalitarian states, and do things in a big way. A third might be the American taxpayer, through whose money NASA is able to conduct many technical and scientific programs. If it is the taxpayer, then Cooper obviously meant to appeal only to those taxpayers who are Christians. I hope you understand that I have no objection to Cooper's anthropomorphizing God, to his imagining a human-like deity who rules the universe. It is not the fact that he has imagined, it is what he has imagined. What it comes down to in Cooper's prayer is that God is an American, tax-paying Christian who supports the space program, favors democratic political systems, wants more research done, and, for all we know, believes in publish or perish. In Cooper's construct of God, not only does God not rule over the universe and all that's in it, he doesn't even rule over Yugoslavia. In short, though it takes the form of a prayer, Cooper's language is a celebration of America's supremacy, not God's. It is dominated by the language of politics, not religion. In substance, it lacks many things that a prayer should contain, including transcendence, universality, and especially an acknowledgement of God's majestic indifference to the political maneuvers of a particular group of people. Is it crazy or stupid talk? I would be inclined to the former. But you must keep in mind that these terms do not refer to real things, in the sense that eyeglasses or cigarettes are real. They are intended, in fact, to suggest a direction toward which we might look in order to find out what is wrong, either with the person's use of language or with the situation in which it is used. If, in constructing such a prayer, Cooper was merely reflecting his own limitations, we would have a fairly clear example of stupid talk. He would simply be telling us that he does not really know what a prayer consists of, beyond that it requires one to say, Father, Amen, and a few other technical words. But there is some evidence that this impoverished conception of religion is widely shared by other people. There were certainly many citizens who were deeply moved by Cooper's prayer. This suggests that we live in a land where the goals of the state are increasingly identified with the goals of God. And for that reason, I say that Cooper's prayer is not so much a matter of ineffectiveness, but a general tendency in the culture to obliterate the distinction between the language of politics and the language of religion, a tendency promoted, incidentally, by both right-wing clerics, example, the late Francis Cardinal Spellman, and left-wing clerics, example, William Sloan Coffin. Here you will notice I am introducing another parameter to the difference between stupid and crazy talk. Stupid talk is apt to be an expression of individual weakness, a failure on the part of one person to see what a semantic environment is supposed to do and how it does it. Stupid talk usually has no implications beyond the immediate situation and is often correctable by someone's calling attention to unanticipated consequences. A failure on the part of one person to see what a semantic environment is supposed to do and how it does it. Stupid talk usually has no implications beyond the immediate situation and is often correctable by someone's calling attention to unanticipated consequences. In thinking that cars make left turns and that they make them badly, J. Edgar Hoover was talking stupid, not crazy. The sentence, "There shall be no left turns made by this car," is not one that resonates throughout culture. But the sentence, "God is an American," and in any case, is not a communist. is such a sentence. In my way of thinking, it is crazy talk. It has implications for several semantic environments, tending to extinguish the differences among them. It is a sentence that impoverishes a culture, not merely an individual. You might even say that stupid talk is a question of individual error, while crazy talk is a question of collective error. As in the following example, sometimes people get the notion that the purpose of EST is to make you better. It is not. I happen to think that you are perfect exactly the way you are. The problem is that people get stuck acting the way they were instead of being the way they are. Or, you might say, vice versa. This specimen is an example of the language of therapy, instant variety, and comes out of the mouth of Werner Erhard, who is the founder of Erhard Seminars Training, EST. Erhard has also said, "The purpose of EST training is to transform your ability to experience living so that the situations you have been trying to change or have been putting up with clear up just in the process of living." Thousands of people have enrolled in EST, and not a few have claimed that they no longer act the way that they were and instead spend their time being the way they are. They pay a fair amount of money to learn what that just is in the last quote, and they learn it in 60 hours of more or less continuous training. According to Mel Ziegler of the San Francisco Chronicle, this training consists largely of interminable, scatologically cluttered harangues, driving again and again at what clearly emerged as the point, that the trainees in the room were all sick because they had brought on themselves everything that had ever gone wrong for them in their lives. Now, I do not say that some of these Esters do not, in fact, feel better when they have finished giving their money and attention to S trainers. I do not know the percentage of success, although it should be pointed out that about 50% of all patients who enter mental hospitals improve, i.e. feel better, no matter what sort of treatment they get, and even if they get none. There is no telling what will make some people feel better. Sometimes a lobster dinner will do it, or a raise in pay, or even reading a good book. Of course, meeting a lot of fellows and girls also helps. The point I wish to stress here is that the helpfulness of Erhard's language is largely beside the point. If you tell people that they are perfect, except for the way they act, that just the process of living will clear up their problems, that they have brought on everything that has ever gone wrong for them, and that what they are is not reflected in what they do, you may, for all I know, make quite a lot of distracted people feel good. You will also have shown once again that Erman Burke was wrong. When all else fails, people do not turn to reason. They usually turn to gibberish. I have no doubt that many individuals have received spiritual sustenance from ESP stories, numerology, the burning of witches, astrology, exorcism, mumbling to themselves, messages from outer space, and other higher forms of consciousness. I am equally sure that Hitler made many discontented Germans feel good about themselves. The Inquisition probably did wonders for the Christians, and bombing the Vietnamese back to the Stone Age was possibly a peak experience for millions of Americans. And while I do not mean to compare EST to any of the hideous events I have just mentioned, it must take its humble place in the spacious museum of crazy talk. For though crazy talk comes in many varieties and magnitudes, it is essentially an attack on reason itself. It may cloak its purpose as science or religion or therapy or politics, but its most profound strategy is to bypass or defy our capacity to reason. And that capacity, as Spinoza taught, is the source of all ethical behavior. It is also the one talent lodged in us whose denial makes us less human. The problem of crazy talk, in other words, is not in what it does for you, but in what it does to you. Crazy talk, even in its milder forms, requires that we be mystified, suspend critical judgment, accept promises without question, and frequently abandon entirely the idea that language ought to be connected with reality. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, Erhard typically speaks in the following manner, talking to one of his trainers. "Ted, I haven't yet had the space to tell you this, but I want to acknowledge that I'm clear about your appropriate contribution in helping resolve Stewart's immigration problems. And Don, Cox, who runs the business of EST, will validate the mechanical part of helping you experience my acknowledgement." Ziegler interprets this to mean, "Ted, you did a nice job with Stewart's immigration, and I told Don to give you a bonus." He may be right, but I'm not sure. Erhard, for his part, says that such talk is incredibly useful and actually important when you are describing something that's new, because what it does is it allows people to know that you're not describing something that's old, or vice versa. Now it is clear that Erhard's way of talking is far from stupid.
He has made quite a lot of money from sentences such as these, and that is the point. He has struck a rich vein in the culture, the tendency to separate words from any specific reference, to make gibberish itself into a semantic environment.
Such a tendency can be seen in advertising, government, radical politics, astrology, guruism, instant therapies, and other forms of popular entertainment. When one person uses rootless language, we might think of it as stupid talk. But when a fairly large population responds enthusiastically to it, when we find a whole subculture adopting the same pattern, it is useful to think of it as crazy talk. For what we are faced with is not an aberrant remark, but an aberrant semantic environment. The problem of crazy talk is, therefore, very close to uncorrectable. It does not involve a momentary loss of judgment, subject to review in a more rational moment. Crazy talk usually puts forward a point of view that is considered virtuous and progressive. Its assumptions, metaphors, and conclusions are therefore taken for granted, and that, in the end, is what makes it crazy. It is language that cannot get outside of itself. It buries itself in its own foundations. Here, for example, is a specimen taken from Red Stocking's manifesto. Women are an oppressed class. Our oppression is so total, affecting every facet of our lives. We are exploited as sex objects, breeders, domestic servants, and cheap labor. We identify the agents of our oppression as men. Male supremacy is the oldest, most basic form of domination. All other forms of exploitation, racism, capitalism, imperialism, etc., are extensions of male supremacy. Before saying anything about this language, I think I ought to make it plain that I believe in the equality of the sexes, that no female should be denied whatever opportunities are available to males. I mention this because it is in the nature of most isms and dodgies that criticism of any part of the ism affects a rejection of the whole. Therefore, one is required to show one's colors, so to speak, before one may offer criticism of any sort. Having said that, I feel somewhat more comfortable in remarking that the language I have just quoted is, in some respects, not far removed from Paul Blabel's analysis of the events at Babi Yar. If you talk about Russians and Jews as subhuman beings, you have created a context in which you are capable of knowing what they experience. And if you talk about men as total oppressors and women as totally exploited, you have constructed a context that bears almost no relation to the actual experience of men and women. Crazy talk is, in fact, almost characterized by simple-minded conceptions of complex relationships. One way it achieves this is through the construction of a massive metaphor, which permeates every sentence and does not allow for any perceptions that go beyond the bounds of the metaphor. In the foregoing instance, we are presented with a vicious and uncompromising paradigm. Man-woman relationships are a war between master and slave. It follows for this that a woman who gives birth to a child is a breeder, and a woman who stays home with children while her husband works is a domestic servant and cheap labor. It follows as well that there can be no such things as mutual dependency, or love, or even a family, since such transactions do not arise in class war. It also follows that it is only an illusion that some men have sacrificed their own well-being for their families, since masters do not do such things for slaves. In short, to talk this way is to distort, beyond recognition, a complex situation as it is actually experienced by most men and women. Of course, the passage I am discussing represents an extreme position. But what makes a position extreme? It is language that settles a matter once and for all, language that does not take into account contradiction and ambiguity, language which eagerly suppresses facts and does not fit its premises, language that is self-confirming. The self-confirming aspect of crazy talk is particularly interesting. For example, it is sometimes asserted that a man referring to his wife as my wife or my woman demonstrates the truth of the claim that marriage is a simple master-slave relationship, but the word my is an extremely complicated word, and in fact may demonstrate exactly the opposite of what is claimed for it. When you say of what is on your wrist that it is my watch, you certainly mean that you own it. It is yours to do with as you wish. But when you say of where you live that it is my country, you mean almost the opposite. For if anything, it is the country that owns you. Certainly, in talking of our God, we do not simply imply that we own him, but just the opposite. Whatever the phrase my wife may have implied 100 years ago, not even Archie Bunker would take it to mean a staple case of ownership today. For most people, I would imagine it is a statement of commitment to or responsibilities for another person. In any case, the relationships between men and women are characterized not only by antagonisms and inequalities, but by acts of great sacrifice, tenderness, and devotion. And I would say that any language pattern which excludes the sacrifice, tenderness, and devotion in the framework of marriage is a form of crazy talk, a lowering and not a raising of consciousness. It is one thing to say that there are still imbalances and inequalities in this relationship. It is quite another to say that in marriage, men own their women, to do with as they will, for the general purpose of keeping them oppressed. The first can lead to inquiry and actions. The second is a propagandistic distortion of great destructive power. Stupid talk is an individual mistake whose unfortunate consequences are usually immediate and observable by others within the semantic environment. This does not mean that there can be no argument about it. Stupid talk is still an opinion given by one fallible human being about the remarks of another fallible human being. But because the semantic environment itself is not in question, stupid talk is limited in its scope, and its presence may be detected in the fact that something that ought to have happened hasn't, or something that ought to not have happened has. Rarely does it involve fundamental questions of value, and for that reason, stupid talk is often easy to correct, or at least to avoid next time. Crazy talk, on the other hand, grows from a challenge to the semantic environment itself. It establishes different purposes and assumptions from those we normally accept. It has, therefore, wide-ranging consequences and is a form of collectivized nonsense. Crazy talk cannot, of course, be verified or refuted by facts. You cannot prove that putting people in gas chambers even lacks charm, let alone humanity. And you cannot prove that love or marriage ought to be something more than class war, or that appeals to God ought somehow to be different from the Pledge of Allegiance. You can only assert these things and try to show how their denial is destructive to the human enterprise. I have previously stated, for example, that a society's health depends on its having clearly differentiated purposes. There is no way to prove that this is so, except in a long-range view, and even then, there are philosophers who will argue the opposite. But, as you have concluded by now, my definitions of both stupid and crazy talk stand or fall on certain commonplace normative concepts. For example, I hypothesize a world in which road signs are made clear because it is desirable to reduce accidents, a world in which gas chambers are thinkable only by people gone mad, a world in which prayer expresses obeisance to God, not the state, a world in which no one is perfect, and in which there are no 60-hour therapies to remedy the troubles of life, least of all therapies involving the blaming of oneself for everything. And I hypothesize a world in which men and women come together to overcome the alienation that separation brings, and not to overcome each other. You will agree, I think, that there is nothing novel in such values, although you may think them ill-conceived. Wherever you do think them unwarranted, at that point will my conception of stupid and crazy talk be both unacceptable and useless to you. But there must be a standard of human behavior against which we can measure what we say and do. I like thinking that mine, in general, reflects the idea contained in Jacob Bronowski's line that we are nature's unique experiment to make the rational intelligence prove itself sounder than the reflex. In the 5 chapters that you have now completed, I have been trying to suggest what that line means to me, but I am not yet finished doing it. In part 2, I will catalog some of the specific mechanisms and myths through which the rational intelligence is defeated, and our reflexes help to gain dominion. When you have read part 2, you will understand my values more clearly and be able to decide how to construe the advice I give in part 3, or whether or not to bother with it at all.
Context of white supremacy. End of the first audio segment, Neil Postman, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk and What to Do About It. We will pick up very beginning of part two, the introduction. Very beginning of part two, introduction. Wowie, I was a little hesitant, uncertain after last week. I didn't know if I had just picked some moldy academic book written by a suspected racist to bring on the book club. But wowee, at least for myself, man, I felt great about picking this text. Wowee. I read this book and Mr. Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, which was written a number of years later. This book that we're reading now was written in 1976. But I read those two books back to back. And within a matter of months, The Cows was born. You can see the influence, I think. The number to dial if you would like to share a thought, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you want to join us but you do not have a phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. The address, if you need it, is tinytiny.cc/1race, and that is the number 1. When you enter that address again, tinytiny.cc/1race, that is the number 1. When you enter that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The top line is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can enter real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will, you should be able to connect to the live broadcast and you should be able to hear us. Live broadcast shouldn't be any problem. If you're interested in participating, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. It will raise your hand. I'll see you on the switchboard and we can get you on the line. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. Line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? So this is my first segment hearing Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, and it was interesting because it sounded like it was sort of an indictment on, like, white supremacy, Western civilization, like their whole thought process. I found it interesting because, you know, the words, pretty much, you know, the words that are being used are English words or Western concepts, I guess. And I guess it just kind of reveals like part of the psyche of how like language is used as a weapon and how it can be used to completely confuse us about how this system works. And thank you.
That is interesting. An indictment of the white I guess Western way of thinking and language use as a weapon, weaponizing of language use. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you'd like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, my dear.
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers, listeners. Gratitude and thanks to the young lady that's reading. I have to say that this was an excellent choice because, Gus, you have always said that words were important, and talking about metaphors and how, you know, they can confuse the idea. And then if we are in a system of white supremacy, which I believe that we are, then, and basically in a war, then a war would be fought on this level of, you know, language and thought and all that. Now, whites are controlling this. I like the part in the book where it says words are not only tools to think with, they are all practical purposes, by all practical purposes, the content of our thought. That explains why almost every white person you get on the show, you're talking to them for a long time. A lot of years I was listening, I'd say, I just want one white person to get on there and not get shown up as the racist that he is. And I'm still listening. They all show themselves eventually. It is said that language is not only the vehicle of thought, but also the driver. So words it's very important in the semantic environment, you know, that you use, and each semantic environment has its own set of vocabulary. So if you were in a hospital situation, you would be using different words than you would use if you were in a church or if you were at a ball game. So where you start the confusion is when that the words do not fit the semantic environment. It says, what meanings we give to the world, what sense we make of things derived from our power to name, to create a vocabulary. Now, if you think about the people who actually name and create vocabularies, then we would have the basis of this race and white supremacy system that we're trying to survive in. And then if we are going to effectively survive in this system, then we need to master these concepts that's in this book. And I think that we should be very serious about this. I think that's why Gus is excited about the book. It's almost like everything that he's been saying. The book is also saying, you know, it's stupid and crazy talk, but how we can defeat ourselves by the way we talk and what to do about it. So he's got a lot of so-called experts that he's using. These are psychiatrists or professors or behavioral scientists. So we just have to go along with his summation of, you know, some of these concepts. Because when he used people like George Herbert Mead, you know, the sociologist that got deep into the I and the me and self-improvement, then you can start to come to terms with, you know, what he's saying, I think. And he's covering the nine areas of human activity, which I can appreciate. But when he started talking about the House Committee on Un-American Activities, now that, if anybody can, we can remember, you know, it was just like a witch hunt. And so they can make up these, what is un-American activities? You know, what describes? That's why Mr. Fuller says all the time, stay in the question lane. There's something that's confusing you. Ask for a clarification or definition of a certain word. In the book, he says, I do not wish to imply that the metaphorical biases in every semantic environment are destructive, only that they are apt to be hard to see and therefore requires close scrutiny. Well, you know, to me, that spells destructive, especially for non-white people, because if it's going to take some close scrutiny, and then we don't even know what they're talking about in the first place. I had a supervisor once who was telling me, Gimry, what you're saying is six in one hand, half a dozen in the other. To this day, I don't know what the hell he was talking about, but I never did ask him. Well, what do you mean? The part when he said religion, for its part, has had its craziest moment when it tried to provide scientific description. You know, I agree with that. And that Paul Blobel, the guy responsible for the massacre of 30,000 Jews, whites playing the victim. We even see that today. He's going to say, I guess it was Baba Yar, that our men who took part in these executions suffered more than those who had been shot. You know, that's the same attitude that whites take about non-whites in America today. And Gordon Cooper's prayer, basically you can just, that is a white conscious type prayer, making God American and democratic. And but basically he did state that through prayer, people put their ambitions, successes, failures, and tragedies in perspective. They humble themselves before greater powers, and by doing so, frequently find themselves uplifted and stronger. And that makes sense. But, you know, he had another. When you shape it, make God the way you want it to be, and all that, and when it becomes destructive, you know, like in the genocide, or when, this is the part, and this will be the last thing that I say, the descriptions of racism, white supremacy in the book, when he was talking about Hitler making discontented Germans feel good about themselves, the Inquisition, you know, I think he said, doing something to the Christians, you know, helping them out, but bombing the Vietnamese back in the Stone Age was quite possibly a peak experience for Americans. You know, I don't think black or non-white people felt that way about the bombing in Vietnam. And I think that he just described racism, white supremacy. And one question. Exactly what was he saying when he was talking about crazy talk cannot, of course, be verified or refuted by facts? And then he said, you cannot prove that putting people in gas chambers even lacks charm, let alone humanity. I wish somebody could explain that to me. I'm missing that. Okay, I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. We had other people that dialed in before I nabbed the caller at 4757. My quick effort to explain Mr. Demrefour's question about what Mr. Postman meant, I think that was right towards the end of the second audio segment, when he was saying that you can't even explain. I think that was in the portion where he was saying that crazy talk is self-confirming. And he said, for example, I'm trying to go to the exact portion because I think I either highlighted that or very close to it. But I think it was in the self-confirming, that crazy talk is self-confirming, that you can't even, you couldn't even prove that putting people in a gas chamber is not charming. I think the basis of his point, he just used that as an example. The basis of his point was that what he's defining as crazy talk, the things that people could say, you could not even bring evidence against what they are saying. And some of the things that he has outlined or used to illustrate to say this is crazy talk. What would you even use as your scale, I guess, for that example? What would you even use as your scale for what is charming, right? Like, how do you even quantify what is charming to say that this is not charming to put these people in a gas chamber? I think that was the basis of what he was trying to get to, that you can't even, there's no evidence, there's no logic that you can use to refute crazy talk. Like, when I think one of the other examples of crazy talk that he gives is that is explicitly white supremacy, the Nazi who was saying that we felt worse, that the Jews, people that we were killing, and Russians, that they weren't humans, that we value life more, so we hurt more than the Jews, people that we were killing. There's no way that you can bring evidence. There's no logic you can use to refute that position. I think that's what he's saying. I could be, you know, misinterpreting. The other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, 4757, did you have commentary you wanted to share?
Hello, can I be heard?
Greetings, Mel, our wonderful narrator.
Okay, some of my points were already touched on by you and Mr. Demery Ford. I am currently taking a speech class, actually, and so in the fourth section of the first part where he talks about content and talks about the mechanics of language, there being a sender, a receiver, a channel for communication, I'm using those exact same terms, I guess very far in the future. I guess this book is written in the 70s, very far in the future, and find that language to still be current. So I'm thinking that the study of language is pretty timeless, or maybe some good terminology just gets passed on, but I was struck that those are the exact same terms that I'm using, but maybe that's not so uncommon. Make America great again. So God and America being just about everything from Democrat to not Democrat, depending on this political season or which book you're reading or what TV show you're watching. I think that the usage of America and its meaning, it does get very, it just kind of gets used as, it gets used for pretty much everything, depending on who wants to talk about it. White supremacists, I think, have used terms like, you know, God does not like Kaepernick kneeling, and stuff like that. So I've seen both of those be used just many times. And it's making me think of the crazy talk by the SS officer. And it's not until he used that example of the Jews being calmly, I guess, being calmed down before they got to the ovens. It wasn't until he used that example that I actually understood what he meant by crazy talk, and that, like you said, it there's no logic to it. And I mean, it's probably obvious to say, but I think then that white supremacy qualifies as crazy talk. I also think it's self-confirming like crazy talk, and where I think it's also in that same part one, chapter four, where he talks about content. He says that the words are the subject. They don't just get like, words are not used to simply talk about a subject, but they themselves become the subject depending on the content of the words. And I was thinking of actually a philosophy video I saw one time that said that the act of speaking is an act. It's not just speech. It's also an act that you're doing. So what you're saying in the speech might not even matter. And I'm thinking of a lot of white supremacist rallies in particular, or speeches that may go on now and in the past, where, again, self-confirming, the act of being a white supremacist is to be able to speak and for there to be no one to stop you and for you to be able to say what you want. That demonstrates white supremacy. It's self-confirming. And that speech itself, it's almost like a circle. It becomes the subject of the next speech. It becomes the subject of, like, mailers or whatever white supremacists send out among each other. That the act of speaking, I guess, is as important, actually, if not more important than the words themselves sometimes. I don't have the book in front of me right now. I had more points, but I can't get to them right now. I'm sorry. I'll chime in on the second time. Thank you.
For sure. Appreciate that. Pitching in and doing the narration while she is not 100%. Appreciate that. The caller 5771, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. Just a few things in regards to the book. When he talks about American and the usage of the word American, I mean, I have, to me, American means white, you know, and white people, because if you look at the historical context of it and how America was formed, you know, by white people and for white people, it basically means white people. So when you talk about, when he talks about un-American, to me, you know, un-American means anybody who's non-white, because I think most of the time, most people look at the term American as like the region of the United States and the citizenship. And when racists use American, they use the term for themselves as white people. So, you know, I thought about that when that topic came up in the book about, you know, the usage of the term American. As I'm reading this book, and you know, you hear the term crazy talking, stupid talking, how it's being defined. You know, first I was thinking about President Trump and, you know, some of the things that he said, but then, I mean, there's a whole bunch of politicians that I thought about, racist politicians that use the same, you know, techniques of words that Donald Trump, you know, uses. And maybe the certain verbiage that Donald Trump uses is different from, you know, some of the other politicians, and we don't catch that, you know, the racist remarks that other politicians, you know, say until like later on when we discover it. So, you know, I was trying to define what like somebody like Donald Trump would be. And I was thinking like, maybe it's crazy talk. Because, you know, even though he talks a lot of things that can't be proven, but the effect that he has on, you know, to galvanize racists in this country is, you know, is remarkable. I mean, this guy could, you know, say a bunch of crazy stuff and, you know, they will believe him to the T, as long as he's, you know, upholding white supremacy. So as I've been reading this book, I've been trying to classify, you know, is he, you know, is it crazy talk or stupid talk? And most of it to me sounds like crazy talk to me. Maybe wrong, but, you know, and we haven't finished the book. So, you know, we'll see. But that's the, you know, that's what I'm holding on to right now. And also I thought about the term white supremacy and how some non-white people confuse that, because, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, I hear some, you know, non-white, especially non-white black people talk about, well, you know, white people aren't supreme, you know, so that's a false term. But the thing is that they don't understand what the definition of supremacy is. It's not, I think people look at it biologically, like, you know, white people are biologically better than, you know, non-white people. But I think they're missing the term of supremacy being a state or a position that they hold in this world. So, you know, white people, you know, run this world and they rule this world right now. So that's why we use the term white supremacy. So I thought about that and was reading the book as well. But that's all I have. I'll be in my line.
Appreciate that. For other folks that have commentary they want to share, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Some of the things that stood out for me in this week's reading, when he starts off, when he says, I think Mr. Demery Ford read the beginning of this paragraph. He says, words are not only tools to think with. And the end of that paragraph, he says that The world consists, I'm saying, however, that what meanings we give to the world, what sense we make of things, derive from our power to name, to create vocabularies. Racist man, racist woman, in my view, one of their chief weapons in creating vocabularies and refining creating terms, they are able to maximize being able to create new terms, new definitions, which means that you have extraordinary influence over the way people talk, the way people think. And I think that's what he's getting at, that words have such a huge impact. I mean, literally, as he says, words are not only the tools to think with, they are, for all practical purposes, the content of our thoughts. That is literally the mechanism by which we do a lot of our thinking with words. And if they're the ones that are fashioning and shaping the terms and definitions that we use, they have a huge influence on what we're going to think, what we're going to do, how we're going to speak. Continuing, when he's talking about the language of drug use and how it varies, if you're hearing a commercial for NyQuil or aspirin or whatever it is, I was thinking this book was written in 76. So now with the current white opioid epidemic, how, yes, you can have all these prescription drugs that they have used this language to prescribe, and it's harmful and given and out and all that. And now you end up with this huge epidemic that could be a part of this whole problem, the use of words and compelling people to take all these drugs and medications. Let's see, next. I just thought it was important where he mentions J. Edgar Hoover classifying Martin Luther King Jr. as his enemy, with all the recent commentary about the black identity extremists, the FBI memo being leaked, ongoing warfare against black people. And Hoover certainly was attacking not just Dr. King, it was any and all black people. We read George Orwell, remind folks, 1984. We read that back at the beginning of 2013, I believe. Wow, it's been a minute. Let's see. Continuing, let's see. Oh man, I thought this was really important. He says a while back that what you call something, I said a while back that what you call something depends on how well and widely you see it. What I mean by this is that some people get locked into the vocabulary of a subject. By locked in, I mean that they have so deeply internalized the words conventionally used to describe something that they seem unable even to imagine a different set of words being applied to the situation. Their perceptions are completely controlled by someone else's vocabulary. I highlighted that entire section like, wow, that is a huge part of the problem right there for every single non-white person in the known universe, that our vocabulary and perceptions have been shaped by racist man, racist woman, racist child, directly, indirectly, and a large part of that counter-racism process is going back and reshaping, refashioning how we use words, what words we use, eliminating some words, the next page over, he says, a more troublesome aspect of the vocabulary of a semantic environment is what I shall call its key words. By this, I mean those simple, non-technical words which appear in every semantic environment, but whose meanings shift as the words pass from one context to another. The first word I thought of, one of my favorites, F-A-I-R. These types of words that are just sitting there. It's not one of those words that people would say like, oh my goodness, what do you mean? When he throws out his list of terms, Planck's constant and statute of limitations and all that. Oh my goodness. Doppelganger. What does that mean? Oh my good. Fair. You know, I know what that means. Even, you know, shifting from context to context, context to context, usage, whether we're talking about somebody's skin or the weather, whatever, justice, the police mauled me, they're not treating me fairly. Those words just right there, consistently have been fashioned in a way that supports the system of racism, white supremacy, and just paying attention to words. Other thing I kind of want to get out as well, I think I said it last week, I'm not aware of Black people writing books like these that are just about language and use of words and how we use words. These types of books, I'm only aware of white people have written these types of books. Are people aware of where Black people have written these types of books about language? And if so, that would be great if they could point them out. Let's see. What else did I get later on? Where he says, for example, when I talk about the process of communication, I tend to imagine it, as you know by now, as a biological process. And that is why I use such terms as soil, environment, growth, pollution. Those who imagine communication as a mechanical process will use such terms as input. And he talks about the each semantic environment is characterized by tendencies towards certain metaphorical constructions of reality. This is quite inevitable, but it also tends to be overlooked by those in the environment, and on that account can be quite dangerous. This is why tomorrow, every compensatory call in, I say no metaphors, because it's very dangerous. People employ these frequently when talking, and a lot of times they just get used. And particularly, I think a lot of times because people will use cliche metaphors. They'll invoke a metaphor. It'll be something that you've heard before. It'll be something that sounds similar or reminiscent. And so you really can lower your suspicion, or I just say you will not interrogate what is being said to see if it actually makes sense. Do they even know what they're talking about? Has this been logically adequately explained, or did they just slide a metaphor in here and, you know, am I asleep at the wheel? Am I not paying attention to what is being said to me right now? Huge part of the problem. And also, even from earlier when he said the importance of being able to come up with different terms, different ways of communicating maybe the same idea or concept, that can be helpful. I think that's also hugely important as we proceed in trying to network in solving this problem. A few other things I will point out and then check in to see if other folks, I guess I'll get in one or two or more things. And then the metaphors, this whole segment, I just, oh my goodness, I totally, I remember why I thought this was such a great book. I read this book, it's been 10 years and I only recently got my own personal copy of this book. I read the library copy of this book and Amusing Ourselves to Death. So this was not in Gus's library to go back and refer to. So I'm seeing this for the first time in about a decade. And wow, I guess this book did have a huge impact on my thinking and, you know, some of the things that carry forward. Metaphors, where he says on page, I guess this is for me, like 65 going to 66, the movement is quite correct in, he's talking about the women's liberation movement, in challenging the validity of these metaphors, especially because metaphors are apt to be so unobtrusively potent in giving direction to our attitudes. One might say that every political science, social, religious, or economic movement represents an attack on a prevailing set of metaphors, an established way of constructing reality. It's been my experience that the metaphors that are invoked most often, not always, but most often, they are saturated with racism, white supremacy. That is what is going to be invoked. That's going to be the standard by which we compare, contrast, all other things, and making sure we're supporting white supremacy as we move along anything else that we're doing. And as unobtrusively that the metaphors are just there and we don't even think about them. We don't even stop for a second to say, what does this even mean? As Mr. Demery Four said, what you're saying right now is six in one hand and a half dozen in the other. Well, wait a minute. Whoa, whoa, whoa. I didn't say anything about a dozen, anything. I was talking about this. Well, let's go back and make sure we've addressed the situation correctly. That happens frequently. That's why I pay attention to it. Was so glad that I was reminded of where I possibly got the inkling to pay attention to metaphors. Also, I do not, this is on page 67, I do not wish to imply that the metaphorical biases of every semantic environment are destructive. only that they are apt to be hard to see and therefore require close scrutiny. Exactly. And which is something we should be paying attention to anyway, paying attention to the use of words. I will stop there, even though I had a few other notes. Red in Ohio, did you have commentary? You should be with us as well.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, and hello to everyone. Just a few short notes. I thought about the terms racial dislocation when the author he was describing pacification with the farmers having to be moved, and he used the term transfer of population, which I thought was interesting. I also appreciated his explanation of good, and it's definitely helping me to, you know, better understand words, and the last thing, or better to use, being able to better utilize words. And the last thing, just in regards to words, just this book is kind of definitely helping me as far as like what other people have said, just, you know, when he speaks about American, and then when I hear people use the term savage, I hate that. And then also the term beauty, which also, you know, in the confusion, in my most confusion and other people around me, you know, trying to be beautiful, is how closely to white you can look. That's all I had to add. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Indeed. Any other comments? Mr. Demery, for your question, I know I gave an answer. Did anybody else want to give a response? Or you can let us know, you know, if it was answered to your satisfaction, Mr. Demery, for his question about what Mr. Postman meant when he said that you, he was talking about crazy talk and the example that you cannot prove that stuffing people in ovens is charming, what he meant with that example. If anybody else wanted to respond to Mr. Demery Ford's question or had their own commentary they wanted to share, anyone else?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
When I heard that part, I just assumed that he was just using, you know, just sarcasm, a real macabre way of sarcasm. I guess I should have been thinking about it a little bit more. That's all I wanted to add. Thank you.
You know, if you look at it in that sense, it seems clearer to me if it's sarcasm. And then your explanation, Gus, brings, you know, some clarification to it also. Because I know he was getting at something, but the way that he used it, it sounded odd. Thanks. I'll mute my line. I wanted to say also about when he started talking about tell it like it is, somebody was going, tell it like it is. You know, and then I thought about how we as black people sometimes say keeping it real, you know, and then what does all of this really mean? You know, what is real and how do you actually keep it real? So, I just want to get that in. I mute my line.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. I had a few other points to get in. If folks have any other comments they want to make, we have about 10 minutes until we get to the second audio segment. A little shorter. We had two kind of thick segments. Did somebody have a comment they wanted to get in? I'm just hearing things.
Can I hear?
Yes, sir.
Just a basic question. Would a proverb be considered a metaphor?
Would a proverb be considered a metaphor?
Yes.
It would depend on, perhaps it would depend on the context. If you're just saying it, if we're just sitting around and you just say you want to share with me, Rolling Stone gathers no moss, right? I wouldn't necessarily say that's a metaphor if you just say that out of the blue, and or I guess maybe so. I guess maybe that might be, it depends. I think some of them, I don't know. Maybe so. Maybe so.
Okay. I was just wondering.
How about allegorical?
Yeah, it's just a question I was kind of like raising in my head. I was thinking if all proverbs are metaphors, or maybe some of them are metaphors. I was just kind of throwing that question out there.
Because they're not really direct most of the time, right? A lot of times some of them can be open to interpretation, right? Like sometimes they're not explicit, right? In terms of whatever conclusion or bit of wisdom you're supposed to take from whatever has been said. Like a lot of times it's something you're supposed to think about, right?
Or even
how it's applied to you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, and this stems off of another question that I was thinking in my head about what are the metaphors used in other languages? Because, you know, I know Proverbs have been around for like centuries. So it's like, you know, I'm pretty sure Proverbs have been developed in other languages besides English. And I was thinking, is English the most heavy metaphorical language on the globe, or, you know, are some other languages equal to that? Or, you know, it's just questions I've been kind of thinking.
That one, I definitely do not know. That would be a good question to ask a linguist, to see if they could, you know, give us some data on that, and in terms of the amount of metaphors that are used in English language in comparison to other language. Don't know. Any other folks have questions or comments they want to get in?
I know where I have. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Demi-4. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say the old African proverbs or the stories, you know, that they tell. You know, a lot of that's metaphor. So, you know, I guess all of the languages would have that. But, you know, he may have something there, the English language having more metaphors in it. I'm new, Bob.
Right on. I think he says the same thing. I know I encourage people not to use, or request that people not use metaphors exclusively on the compensatory call-in on Saturdays. But I say consistently, I use metaphors. I don't tell people not to use them. I just say that we should be very mindful of them, for a lot of the same reasons that Mr. Postman cites, that they get used a lot of times and people are not even paying attention to them, even though they're exerting a lot of influence on how we think and the words that we're using and how we're, you know, processing all this, to pay attention to all that. But certainly use them. Just pay attention. Pay attention when you use them, and pay attention when other folks use them. On page 74, where he says, two major sources of trouble in human affairs are, first, that people use language for bad, inhumane, unattainable purposes, and second, people use language ineffectively in trying to achieve good purposes. We are not talking in this book about words and sentences. We are talking about what they are for and how well they do what they are for. I thought that was excellent. And I think at this point, racists, white supremacists, they use words in a far superior manner than non-white people. Undisputed. The job of counter-racists to get better at the use of words, what they are for and how well they do what they are for. If we are using words to eliminate racism, we've got to make major improvements. Next, where he says on 78, nonetheless, in explaining at Nuremberg what happened at Baba Yar, he said, we already talked about this point, brought this up earlier. Sounds like standard racism, white supremacy, the way that they talk about, read that whites talk about black people, non-white people all the time. Let's see. When he gave his analysis of astronaut Cooper's prayer, I thought that was just a superb kind of deconstruction of racism, white supremacy, even though he doesn't refer to this as racism, white supremacists. He just talks about this as Americanism and supporting American taxpayers who are with the space program and a particular ideology of what America is supposed to be like that would have to, particularly this time period, would have to be dripping with racism, white supremacy, firmly committed to racism, white supremacy. This is not that long after Hidden Figures. So, I mean, you saw what was in the space program from that, right? Book, film, and, you know, more data. Dr. Welsing, Robert Lawrence, right? We heard from her brother-in-law and what he went through. So through and through with racism, white supremacy, but him dissecting every aspect of it in terms of who he is specifically talking about and the political ideology that is coming through, even in what's supposed to be a prayer and the lack of there's supposed to be some reverence or acknowledgement of a higher being that isn't there, because in the system of white supremacy, the religion of white supremacy, racist man, racist woman, racist child, they are the God. There is no one to look up to. It is us. We are just, you know, dominating the known universe. We are He says that they're not looking to a God that is reigning over the universe. We are reigning over the universe. It's them. I just thought that the way that he deconstructed that prayer and he ends up classifying it as crazy talk, I would say you could just add to that. That is the religion of white supremacy. And you see it coming through in the prayer. I thought that was a great point. In fact, I had a lot more points, but I'll stop there. Just did anybody have any thoughts on the way he deconstructed the prayer? Any additional thoughts on that? That didn't stand out as significant to anyone. I have other points. Did the point when he was talking about the prayer, did that stand out as significant to anyone? Any thoughts on that?
I thought it was very significant.
Go ahead. It stood out to me also. I mentioned about it in my commentary. You know, the way that he put himself, the position he put himself in, and then the position I guess he had God in, it's all distorted because just like Gus says, look like if you feel superior or supreme, then how are you going to humble yourself to a higher power, and then just your speech and the language, the words that you say, will reveal how your thought pattern is. I'm you, Paul.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
The one thing that I thought about when he was dissecting the prayer was in the beginning, it kind of almost seemed like how suspected racist. It almost seems like trickery. They will make you think that, you know, they're speaking to everyone, but then, you know, as other people have stated during the call, it kind of then, you know, and also the author kind of then tailored itself towards Americans, you know, American likely equaling white, and then God, which, you know, if you're not a Christian or Argus, you know, or atheist, what have you, then, you know, it would also kind of equal, you know, non-white if you don't believe in Christianity or what have you. So it kind of, that's what it made me think about it. It first made me think that, you know, he is, you know, I guess was speaking to maybe all Americans at the time. And then he's kind of veered off or went back or reverted to his possibly white supremacist ways. Thank you.
Do you have anybody else who was going to comment on the prayer? Did we miss anybody? Maybe I thought we had one other person who was going to speak up. Before we get to the second audio, I definitely wanted to make sure I got in the portion he said on 84 that a lot of times when When all else fails, people do not turn to reason. They usually turn to gibberish. Man, oh man, that is frequently the case, unfortunately, when the subject turns to racism, white supremacy, because it is a problem and it's impacting so many people and it's been a problem for so long and people get so emotional about it. Not, I mean, it is something to be emotional about, but that can't dominate, you know, logic in terms of how we process and communicate what's happening and what should be done to solve this problem. But man, gibberish frequently will take over. And it's my view, that's one of the things that racist man, racist woman, whites, they'll do in conversation dialogue about racism. They will promote gibberish, gibberish use of language, white privilege, and white fragility. They'll promote gibberish talk that does not correctly, adequately, accurately explain what it means to be white, what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. That's one of the prime things that they do in these conversations, and their skillful use of words. I will stop there. I had other highlights, but I will stop there. We will pick up. We are in starting very beginning of part two of the text. We should pick up at the introduction, which for me is on page number. Okay, for me, it's on page 95. So this is Neil Postman's Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk and What to Do About It. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
Part two, Introduction. Therefore, it seemeth to me that the truest way to understand conversation is to know the faults and errors to which it is subject, and from thence every man to form maxims to himself whereby it may be regulated. Jonathan Swift, Hints Toward an Essay on Conversation. The faults and errors to which Swift is here referring include talking too much about yourself, and pedantry, which he defines as attaching too much importance to your knowledge, whether that knowledge be philosophy or cooking. These are certainly elementary talking errors, and may properly be called stupid talk, since, as Swift predicts, they invariably have the effect of achieving almost the exact opposite of what the speaker intends. In the section that follows, there is no discussion of these particular errors, nor is there any discussion of several others that might easily come to mind. I have included only the faults and errors which impress me as the most serious obstacles to the achievement of effective discourse within a rational semantic environment. If, up to this point, my discussion of stupid and crazy talk has been too general or even ambiguous, then I offer the following 17 small chapters as a remedy. They form my operational definition of stupid and crazy talk. They analyze certain beliefs, habits of speech, and structural characteristics of language which play an indispensable role in the production of nonsense of all sizes and shapes. The Communication Panacea. In the search for the Holy Grail of complete harmony, liberation, and integrity, which it is the duty of all true Americans to conduct, adventurers have stumbled upon a road sign which appears promising. It says in bold letters, "All problems arise through lack of communication." Under it, in smaller print, it says, "Say what is on your mind. Express your feelings honestly. This way lies the answer." A dangerous road, it seems to me. It is as true to say, "This way lies disaster." I would not go as far as Oliver Goldsmith, who observed that the principal function of language is to conceal our thoughts, but I do think that concealment is one of the important functions of language, and on no account should it be dismissed categorically. As I have tried to make clear earlier, semantic environments have legitimate and necessary purposes of their own, which do not always coincide with the particular and pressing needs of every individual within them. One of the main purposes of many of our semantic environments, for example, is to help us maintain a minimum level of civility in conducting our affairs. Civility requires not that we deny our feelings, only that we keep them to ourselves when they are not relevant to the situation at hand. Contrary to what many people believe, Freud does not teach that we are better off when we express our deepest feelings. He teaches exactly the opposite, that civilization is impossible without inhibition, silence, reticence, restraint, and yes, even dishonesty can be great virtue, in certain circumstances.
They are, for example, frequently necessary in order for people to work together harmoniously. To learn how to say no is important in achieving personal goals, but to learn how to say yes when you want to say no is at the core of civilized behavior. There is no dishonesty in a baboon cage, and yet, for all that, it holds only baboons. Now there are, to be sure, many situations in which trouble develops because some people are unaware of what other people are thinking and feeling. If only I'd known that, the refrain goes, when it is too late. But there are just as many situations which would get worse, not better, if everyone knew exactly what everyone else was thinking. I have in mind, for example, a conflict over school busing that occurred some time ago in New York City, but has been replicated many times in different places. Whites against blacks. The whites maintained that they did not want their children to go to other neighborhoods. They wanted them close at hand, so that the children could walk home for lunch and enjoy the benefits of a neighborhood school. The blacks maintained that the schools their children attended were run down and had inadequate facilities. They wanted their children to have the benefits of a good educational plant. It was most fortunate, I think, that these two groups were not reduced to sharing with each other their real feelings about the matter. For the whites' part, much of it amounted to, I don't want to live, eat, or do anything else with the niggers, period. For the blacks' part, some of it, at least, included, you honky bastards have had your own way at my expense for so long that I couldn't care less what happens to you or your children. Had these people communicated such feelings to each other, it is more than likely that there could have been no resolution to this problem. This seems to have been the case in Boston. As it was, the issue could be dealt with as if such hatred did not exist, and therefore a reasonable political compromise was reached. It is true enough, incidentally, that in this dispute and others like it, the charge of racism was made. But the word racism, for all its ominous overtones, was a euphemism. It conceals more than it reveals. What Americans call a racist public remark is something like, the Jews own the banks, or the blacks are lazy. Such remarks are bad enough, but they are honorifics when compared to the true feelings that underlie them. I must stress that the school problem did not arise in the first place through lack of communication. It arose because of certain historical, sociological, economic, and political facts, which cannot be made to disappear through the miracle of communication. Sometimes, the less people know about other people, the better off everyone is. In fact, political language at its best can be viewed as an attempt to find solutions to problems by circumventing the authentic hostile feelings of concerned parties. In our personal lives, surely each of us must have sample evidence by now that the capacity of words to exacerbate, wound, and destroy is at least as great as their capacity to clarify, heal, and organize. There is no good reason, for example, for parents to always be honest with their children, or their children always to be honest with them. The goal of parenthood is not to be honest, but to raise children to be loving, generous, confident, and competent human beings. Where full and open revelations help to further that end, it is good. Where it would defeat it, it is stupid talk. Similarly, there is no good reason why your boss always needs to know what you are thinking. It might, in the first place, scare him out of his wits and you out of a job. Then, too, many of the problems you and he have do not arise from lack of communication, but from the nature of the employer-employee relationship, which sometimes means that the less money you make, the more he does. This is a problem for a labor organizer, not a communication specialist. Some large American corporations have, of late, taken the line that improved communication between employees and management will solve important problems. But very often, this amounts to a kind of pacification program designed to direct attention away from fundamental economic relationships. It is also worth noting that a number of such corporations have ceased to hold communication seminars in which executives were encouraged to express their true feelings. What happened, apparently, is that some of them decided they hated their jobs, or each other, and quit. Whether this is good or not depends on your point of view. The corporations don't think it's so good, and probably the families of the men don't either. The main point I want to make is that authentic communication is a two-edged sword. In some circumstances, it helps. In others, it defeats. This is a simple enough idea, and sensible people have always understood it. I am stressing it here only because there has grown up in America something amounting to a holy crusade in the cause of communication. One of the terms blazoned on its banners is the phrase real or authentic feelings. Another is the motto, get in touch with your feelings. From what I have been able to observe, this mostly means expressing anger and hostility. When is the last time someone said to you, let me be lovingly frank? The expression of warmth and gentleness is usually considered to be a facade, masking what you are really thinking. To be certified as authentically in touch with your feelings, you more or less have to be nasty. Like all crusades, the communication crusade has the magical power to endow the most barbarous behavior with a purity of motive that excuses and obscures just about all its consequences. No human relationship is so tender, apparently, that it cannot be purified by sacrificing one or another of its participants on the altar of truth. Or, to paraphrase a widely known remark on another subject, brutality in the cause of honesty needs no defense. The point is that getting in touch with your feelings often amounts to losing touch with the feelings of others, or at least losing touch with the purposes for which people have come together. A final word on the matter of honesty, as I have said before, human purposes are exceedingly complex, multi-leveled, and multi-layered. This means that in any given situation, one does not have an honest feeling, but a whole complex of different feelings. And more often than not, some of these feelings are in conflict. If anger predominates at one instant, this does not mean it is more authentic than the love or sorrow or concern with which it is mingled. And the expression of anger alone is no less dishonest than any other partial representations of what one is feeling. By dishonesty, then, I do not merely mean saying the opposite of what you believe to be true. Sometimes it is necessary to do even this in the interests of what you construe to be a worthwhile purpose, but more often, dishonesty takes the form of your simply not saying all that you are thinking about or feeling in a given situation. And since our motives and feelings are never all that clear, to our own eyes, in any case, most of us are dishonest in this sense most of the time. To be aware of this fact and to temper one's talk in the light of it is a sign of what we might call intelligence. Other words for it are discretion and tact. The relevant point is that communication is most sensibly viewed as a means through which desirable ends may be achieved. As an end in itself, it is disappointing, even meaningless, and it certainly does not make a very good deity. Fanaticism. The commonplace image of fanaticism is of an arm-waving hysteric preaching a mad and unholy doctrine. If this were all there were to it, we could dismiss it in a paragraph, not because it isn't dangerous, but because it is so obvious. But fanaticism has many forms, of which wild-eyed hysteria is only the most audible. Some of its deadliest faces have a much quieter aspect. The picture that most readily comes to my mind is that of an experiment conducted many times with minnows and pike. Both species are put in a large tank, but are kept separate from each other by a glass shield. The pike, being very fond of eating minnows, go for them immediately, but, of course, bump into the glass partition. The pike keep trying, 5 times, 10 times, in some cases many more. Then they give up. At that point, the glass partition is removed so that the minnows swim freely amidst the pike, who are hungrier than ever. What happens next? The pike will not eat the minnows. Pike will even starve to death under such conditions. If we were to anthropomorphize the pike, we might say that they are guilty of crazy talk. They have become fixated on a single sentence, the minnows are not available. The sentence originated in a context in which it was both demonstrably true and useful. With the context completely changed, the sentence lingers on, though it is now both demonstrably false and dangerous. Our pike, it seems, are a bunch of depressed, suicidal fanatics. To the minnows, of course, this fanaticism is a godsend, and if Disney were portraying the scene, I would imagine his putting a small, maybe demonic smile on the faces of the minnows. One fish's fanaticism is another's salvation, but in human affairs, fanaticism rarely has a redeeming side. It affects everyone in a semantic environment, and makes the pursuit of intelligent purpose extremely difficult. Fanaticism begins with our falling in love, so to speak, with certain sentences. There's nothing unusual in this, neither is there anything especially dangerous, provided we are willing to permit the sentences to be scrutinized, subject to criticism, and revised as their deficiencies require. But as with most love affairs, the object of our affection is a projection of our own needs, and we will not hear criticism of any sort, at least for a while. That we have nothing in common with our lover, or that he or she will make us into something it is not in our best interest to become, is the sort of observation one can make only if detachment and examination are not viewed as threats. Fanaticism is the internalization of sentences to which we are so attached that we have made them immune to criticism, not only by others, but by ourselves as well. Ironically, our very attachment to such sentences disgraces them, as your lover would be disgraced if you did not permit him or her to be scrutinized by others. The archetypical fanatical response is given in the story about the man who believed he was dead. In an effort to release him from this idea, a psychiatrist asked him if dead men bleed. "Of course not," he replied, whereupon the psychiatrist jabbed the man's finger with a pin so that they could both see the rich red blood flow. The man looked at the blood, at the psychiatrist, and then said, "Well, I'll be damned, dead men do bleed." Now, there is an important difference between our bleeding man and our starving pike. The pike began with a sentence that was true. The man began with one that was false. Like the pike, men certainly plague themselves with once true sentences that have become false through changing conditions. But men can also invent sentences that have no truth in them, and never have, which is generally not the case with animals, whose beliefs are closely connected with the specific requirements of their survival. The ability to conceive of false ideas is man's most important power. It is that which distinguishes us from the animal world and which grants us such wide dominion. To think of an idea that only might be true, or that nature manifestly contradicts, is quite beyond the capacity of a mako shark. In the environment of the sea, a lure and a fishhook are a false idea, which, because the shark has limited imagination, appear to it quite as useful as anything else. To conjecture and speculate and hypothesize about what might be so, even if it is not, is eventually the source of all good ideas. But such power is an affliction, if not balanced by the power to refute and discard. Fanaticism is what happens when the will to refute deserts you. The idea that human intelligence is engaged in its most functional activity when in the process of refutation has been given sophisticated expression by the philosopher Karl Popper. He calls his point of view fallibilism. It proceeds from the simple assumption that all people and their ideas are fallible, and that it is not possible for anyone to know if he or she is in possession of the truth. Therefore, to devote oneself to justifying one's beliefs is, essentially, an act of fanaticism, and the source of much cruelty and injustice. Popper proposes instead an attitude of critical rationalism, which requires that we subject our beliefs to constant criticism in the hope of reducing the extent of their error. In another place, Charles Weingartner and I have called this attitude crap detecting, which tells you how we come from different neighborhoods from Popper's. Other than that, critical rationalism and crap detecting amount to the same thing. They are a positionist position, which leads people to seek reasons why they should believe something. The idea is to seek reasons why one should not believe something. In Popper's view, the history of science is the history of detecting false beliefs, not the history of discovering true beliefs. The significant demarcation between a scientific belief and a non-scientific one is that in the former there exists the possibility of demonstrating that it is false. If there is no way to demonstrate that an idea is false, or even imagine such a demonstration, then you not only have an unscientific idea, but a fanatical one as well. Marxism, psychoanalysis, astrology, sensitivity training, and most forms of mysticism and superstitious cackle not because they are false, but because they are frequently expressed in such a way that they can never be shown to be false. An astrologer can always prove that astrology is correct, but what is the sort of evidence we may use to show that it is incorrect? Similarly, a Freudian analyst can always find evidence to confirm the essential correctness of his view, but if you ask him, "What would you accept as evidence that your view is incorrect?" he has nothing to say. Psychoanalysis is a self-confirming system. The key to all fanatical beliefs is that they are self-confirming. I grant that not all of our beliefs need to be put to such a rigorous test. We do not need to be scientific in every situation we are in. In many social contexts, for example, the function of our talk is not to say true things, but to say pleasing things. Moreover, we sometimes must act as if a certain belief is infallible in order to get on with the business of living. To the extent that such a belief is not maladaptive, we are in no great danger. In a famous passage in a Sherlock Holmes story, the great observer and deductionist reveals to Watson that he does not know that the earth revolves around the sun. To Watson's astonishment, Holmes is completely indifferent to the matter, because, he points out, whichever way it is has no bearing on his life. We all have many such beliefs. Whether they are false or not would make no great difference to the way in which we conduct ourselves. Problems arise when we must act in accordance with some belief, and when that action can have serious consequences. For example, Mr. and Mrs. Joseph Urinco of Absecom Heights, New Jersey, are Jehovah's Witnesses, or were at the time of this incident. Their young daughter, Linda Jean, was struck by a bus on her way to school. She was rushed to the hospital, where it was determined by surgeons that a blood transfusion was necessary to save her life. At that time, the law in New Jersey required parental permission in such cases, and her parents refused to give it on the ground that the Bible forbids the eating of blood. Linda Jean died without ever regaining consciousness. It could be argued, of course, that the Urinkos' concept of living was so constructed that, from their point of view, it was better to have a dead daughter than a live one who had eaten blood. Still, I would offer this as a classic example of fanaticism in action. The Urinkos believed a certain sentence to be infallible. There was no possible way to demonstrate its falsity. That is, it is self-confirming. And it was, finally, maladaptive. It worked against the prospect of health and survival in a real situation. Nonetheless, the Urinkos appeared odd only because today there are not many people who believe in the infallibility of the Bible. But this does not mean our store of infallible ideas is exhausted. The next time you go to a political rally of any kind, example, black liberation, gay liberation, union liberation, taxpayers liberation, you will hear enough to keep your cup overflowing. In fact, the flow of infallible ideas is ensured by the existence of many systems within our culture which claim to offer total and authoritative explanations of human affairs. Capitalism, communism, behaviorism, Catholicism, feminism, guruism, Billy Grahamism, liberalism, scientism. Such systems are not simply points of view from which hypotheses about reality are generated. For true believers, they consist largely of ideas that are not susceptible to testing of any sort. And in fact, this untestability is perhaps the source of their appeal. I can assure you that I am well aware that life is difficult and that each of us can all use the help that is available in sorting things out. I must also tell you that I am not objecting to the content of the systems of belief I have referred to. For all I know, the assertions of Billy Graham or B.F. Skinner or Germaine Greer or the Bible are absolutely correct. Fanaticism resides not in the context of belief, but in the process by which it is asserted. Our only protection from it lies in our will to refute. The true believer syndrome requires some further comment, largely because it is so prevalent. My word for the problem is systemophilia. Systemophilia arises from the assumption that human beings are sufficiently clever, knowledgeable, and multi-perspective to design complete and just about perfect systems of human activity. The much-admired Buckminster Fuller suffers from systemophilia. So did Karl Marx, John Dewey, Basseau, and Joseph Stalin. What these very different men had in common was a belief in the feasibility of total change. Having noticed that the purposes and structures of various human situations were faulty, indecent, or even depraved, they imagined systems which would, in every respect, be more desirable than those that existed. Systemophiles are sometimes greatly praised for their efforts, and we express our admiration by calling them visionaries or prophets. But I think it is worth pointing out that what they propose never works, at least not in the way they have predicted. Propheticizing is a very dangerous enterprise and has rarely been responsible for the unqualified improvement of life. In fact, where human incompetence, injustice, and misery have actually been reduced, the improvement has unusually been the result of ad hoc, piecemeal, sometimes even accidental approaches rather than some well-coordinated, comprehensive plan. Why, this is so easy enough to figure out. Human beings are, of course, fallible. We make mistakes by the carload. And not because of bad intentions. We make them because we do not know enough or cannot see in more than one direction at a time. We cannot even remember our past clearly, let alone predict our future. And yet, systemophiles do not usually take into account the virtual certainty of error in human calculations. They unfold their plans as if error were only an occasional defect in the edifice of human history, whereas error is the name of the building itself. Second, if indeed humanity is making any progress at all, then it has come, and always come, at great expense. Progress is a Faustian bargain, and not always a good one. For every step forward, there is at least one step sideways, and sometimes one or two back. To get progressive, we must unget something of value. One or more poignant expressions of this idea is found in Inherit the Wind, as Henry Drummond speaks to the jury. Gentlemen, progress has never been a bargain. You've got to pay for it. Sometimes I think there's a man behind a counter who says, all right, you can have a telephone, but you'll have to give up privacy, the charm of distance. Madam, you may vote, but at a price. You lose the right. You may. Birds will lose their wonder, and the clouds will smell of gasoline. Darwin moved us forward to a hilltop where we could look back and see the way from which we came. But for this view, this insight, this knowledge, we must abandon our faith in the pleasant poetry of Genesis. Systemophiles do not like this kind of talk because it threatens the purity of their systems. It implies a dark side to what they propose, a contradiction. There is, of course, something about a contradiction that no one loves, but systemophiles hate them most of all. You can judge this for yourself the next time you hear or read of a comprehensive proposal to redesign our transportation system, or school system, or political system, or legal system. What you will find missing from it are any prophecies about what will go wrong, what mistakes will be made, or what negative consequences will arise from it. These considerations are absent because systemophiles create plans based on oversimplified assumptions and one-dimensional metaphors. In an effort to reduce a situation to a single set of clear principles, systemophiles have to ignore all paradoxes, contradictions, and competing principles. They have to overlook the possibilities of error and to pretend that nothing of value can be lost. As Lewis Mumford points out, life cannot be reduced to a system. The best wisdom, when so reduced to a single set of insistent notes, becomes a cacophony. Indeed, the more stubbornly one adheres to a system, the more violence one does to life. System mongers, as Mumford calls them, seek to enforce acceptance by an entire community of some limiting principle and to design life in conformity to it. If life will not go along, then so much the worse for life, which is, of course, crazy talk.
That will wrap us for our second study session. We are making extraordinary time on this text. We might only have three sessions left. We'll have to see, but wowee, we are rolling. Context of White Supremacy, Neil Postman's Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. All of the folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, we have about a half hour before we wrap things up. Line should be open. Feel free to chime in. I guess we'll start with Emmy since we did not hear from her at all first time around. Emmy, if you have commentary, feel free.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I didn't speak the first time because I actually didn't get to hear that the first section. I came in right as the dialogue began. But the second part that I listened to had a lot of, I took a lot of notes. There were a lot of things that I think I need to sit on and ruminate and think about a little bit more. But I think, I guess I'll just start and try to get as many as I can in. I think it's important to note that the link that communication has a function. And I think that when he talks that, I'm sorry, I'm not all together. So he's talking about communication functioning or as a way to be civil. At the top of 98, he says that civility requires not that we deny our feelings, only that we keep them to ourselves when they are not relevant to the situation at hand. I didn't know that when I was younger.
And I actually thought like the complete opposite. I felt that everyone needed to know how I felt about every single thing, and I didn't want to hold anything back. And as I got older, I learned that that's not true, and that it is actually intelligent to hold some things back. And so I appreciated that. And because it allows you to move, it allows you to learn and to avoid very sticky or bad situations, and to be able to see further into the future what's going to happen when you're not all caught up in your feelings and trying to make everybody else understand how you feel about things. And I think that when he says that the more at the bottom of 101, the point is that getting in touch with your feelings often amounts to losing touch with the feelings of others. I think there's some truth to that. And it could just be for me in my own journey. I feel like the more I become more of myself, the less concerned I am about how other people feel about it, or feel about how whatever it is I feel about. And sometimes I just don't care. Maybe that's too honest. But anyway, then in fanaticism, I was grateful that he went ahead and defined it, because I was like, I was a little bit confused. But I think his definition is clear. And saying that it's an internalization of senses to which we are so attached that we have made them immune to criticism. And I will share this, that I made a very clear transition. I used to be all into the astrology, the mysticism. Like, I could write a natal chart, you know, break that down, all the 12 houses and everything. And after being around so many people for so long, and I met many gurus and all that stuff. And I realized that it was not scientific. It wasn't real. For me, it was not real. For other people, it could be, but for me, it was not. And I let it go. And I began to frame myself more and more in a logical way, to begin to think more logically. And if I could not confirm it, then I didn't have a real use for it. Like, I wanted to be here. And not like in the stars. And so far it's been constructive, it's been productive, and it's been healthy to actually think that way. And it's allowed me to see things that were difficult to see before. And I think that whole realm of, not to say that maybe there isn't some truth to it, to that which we don't see actually existing, you know, like the power of manifestation and whatnot. I'm not saying that that doesn't have relevance, but I think it creates a pattern of behavior and thinking that's not productive. It's not constructive. It allows you to be kind of in this worldly place. And so anyway, when he said that, I thought that that made a lot of sense. And he says, and towards the bottom of 105, the ability to conceive of false ideas is man's most important power. It is that which distinguishes us most from the animal world and which grants us such wide dominion. I just wanted to note that I think that that's so true, that we can make up fake stuff, whereas other organisms can't. It is what it is. They do what they do. They perform their function, and that's just what it is. But we have the ability to lie and to make up stuff, which other people call imagination. This would be the last thing I say, just because I don't want to take up too much time, but he says on 106 towards the bottom, the significant demarcation between a scientific belief and a non-scientific one is that the former, there exists a possibility of demonstrating that it's false. Kind of going back to what I was saying with the whole astrology thing, I think that we are encouraged as non-white people to live on that side of things. That's why Christianity and religion and all that stuff, and we're told that we're really spiritual people and we're all of these things. So then we believe that, like, that's where we're supposed to be. Like, that's whatever it is, whether it's Jesus and God, or it's Muhammad and Islam, or it's the stars and astrology, or this new yoga thing or meditate, whatever it is. And not to say that it doesn't have any relevance or that it can't be helpful or to exist only on prayer. And that cuts us off, I think, from being scientific, logical, rational, clear thinking, and even linear. And like, even in academia, they try to instill within us that Eurocentric folks or Eurocentric perspective is linear and all this other kind of stuff, whereas the Afrocentric one is circular and all this. And I'm not saying that may not be true, but I'm saying that I don't think that it's necessarily one or the other. And so when we get pushed on that side and we take that on as if that's us, that we cut ourselves off from being scientists and mathematicians, which means logical thinking people who can put one and one together and get two and not something else, and leave it up to whatever people say it could be. Like, I think because we have a serious problem that we need to deal with, that that logical linear way of thinking is helpful. Thank you.
Indeed, not gibberish. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary for Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, feel free.
Yes, ma'am.
Can I be heard?
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Quickly, I did appreciate the author's story about Jehovah's Witnesses. I have quite a few Jehovah's Witnesses in my family, and it kind of made me think about his explanation of fanaticism, which it. And I liked how he said that the Jehovah Witnesses, they much rather had a dead daughter than, a live one, just because of their beliefs. The sentence that, in the beginning of the segment, when he spoke about not being truthful to children when it could be detrimental, made me think about how a lot of the white guests, if not all the white guests on the cows, they seem like they don't really, no matter how much, you may ask for honesty, they still refuse to be honest. And that just goes back to, Black people being children. You don't have to be honest with children. The last thing that I had, actually two more things, kind of the comparison between, of course, the Black liberation movement and the gay liberation movement was brought up in the segment, which, that comparison gets tiring. The last thing is the sentence when he said to get progressive or to be progressive, we may have to give up or unget something of value. I don't have the book in front of me, but I tried to hurry up and write it down. And that definitely made me think about, how whites, they don't want to give up their supremacy, because they're going to have to. Whenever I hear, equality, and even more recently in the news, how, now they're saying that affirmative action is, I forgot the terminology, but it's reverse racism. And that's basically what he's saying in that sentence. So I definitely thought that was profound. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Anti-white bias or anti-white discrimination. I think that's how they'll phrase it often. Mr. Demery Ford, did you have commentary?
Yes. I wanted to mention on page 101, it was talking about authentic communication. The part he said, in our personal lives, surely each one of us have ample evidence by now that the capacity of words to exacerbate, wound, and destroy is at least as great as the capacity to clarify, heal, and organize. I think that's very true. And as non-white Black people, we know how damaging words can be. It's in the news. It happens to you almost every day. We have, a certain amount of stress that we live up under. And it's almost like, it doesn't take much to create an episode of anger or hostility, especially from some of these white people with their supremacist attitude. Another thing that he mentioned was getting in touch with your feelings. From what I have been able to observe, this mostly means expressing anger and hostility. So you think about in, like if you're in group therapy or whatever, and they tell everybody, get in touch with your feelings. They really don't want to actually know what those people are actually feeling, because they probably have to shut the program down, to be honest. And last, to be certified as authentically in touch with your feelings, you more or less have to be nasty. And so I just wanted to share that part. I agree with that. I'll mute my line. One other thing, was incorrect behavior, but once early in my career, I would go in sometime to a work situation and just tell them, which one is it going to be? Which one is it going to be? I'm on the edge right now, and the first one that crosses me, I'm going to let you have. That wasn't correct, but I don't know if that's the reason why I didn't get promoted for 16 years. But I'll mute my line on that. Thanks, sir.
Yes, sir. Wow. Keeping it real. Did we have other folks who had commentary they wanted to share? We have about 15 minutes left on the broadcast, so you should not lollygag. Go ahead and speak up if you have commentary you would like to share. Do we know? Let's see. Our narrator, Mel, with us. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. A few points. I did not get to write them all down. So on page 107, he talks about how the earth revolves around the sun. And I don't know where I'm going with that point, because I wrote that quote down, and this is what I mean. I did not finish. I'm sorry. Okay. So on page 99, he was talking about the school busing situation in New York and how the white people, how he says it, you know, it's very fortunate that they were not reduced to sharing with each other, the black people and the white people, how they felt, I guess, about the, black kids wanting to get on school. I'm not sure if this is after the desegregation laws go into effect. I could be just, I have no historical context on this. He does say that this situation is similar to many other situations around the country involving, I guess, schools and buses or race school integration. And I'm thinking that different sources I've heard have said that black people and white people had different motives in not wanting to, Brown versus the Board of Education. White people had one, well, I guess white supremacists had one motive, but black people, I had heard numerous times, wanted more funding for their schools, not necessarily to be integrated into white schools. In some situations, it might have been the opposite. But I'm thinking that I've never seen supremacists not share how they felt to non-white people. I've seen the opposite plenty of times for different reasons, but I've never seen, like, reduced sharing with each other how they felt. Like, I've heard plenty of white supremacists during the time of possibly the New York school busing situation, just school integration in general, say how they felt about black children, black adults, and everybody. I thought that was an interesting statement. I'm not sure what to make of it. When he says that on 104, the pike fish starve to death rather than eating the minnows, when there's like a glass partition between them and they try so many times and they can't do it, it did remind me a little bit of racism. Supremacists saying things like fanatic about race. You're obsessed with it. You know, you just because you down so many times doesn't mean you have to constantly be the white man or something like that, you know? And I'm wondering if that's a fair representation of the minnow, because for us, I think there is reason, there's a logical reason why we would not be encouraged to do the things we attempted to do after failing so many times. I don't think that, I'm not saying he's categorizing us as fanatics, but just when you said the example of the minnows, it just reminded me of that sort of rhetoric of it's because it seems like it's evident that the minnows can't be caught. I don't, maybe I'm reading too much into the fish. let's see. When he says on page 100 that the goal of parenthood is not to be honest with your children, and likewise not necessarily be honest with you, that you're supposed to be, I think, a confident, complex, generous, and kind adult. And I was trying to get how much being honest contributes to that. Something that Mr. Fuller says often about, for instance, if you commit a murder or if you do something, then maybe it's just if you commit a murder or another similar serious situation that everyone in the world should know about it, how that would affect the child of a murderer. That statement it's interesting. It's something I want to highlight, but I'm not sure. I was not able to figure out where I wanted to go with that, but I'm going to see if I can find my older points. I have a few pages here of scribbles. So I'll tidy up. I'll just end that up for now.
Mel looking for her earlier notes from the first audio segment while she is searching. The call at 5771. Did you have commentary as well? 5771.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. Just quickly, everybody pointed out the keeping of feelings to ourselves and civility. It kind of reminds me of the workplace. And, you know, I know we talk about this in workplace racism, about being codified and not, you know, kind of saying what you feel and having a code on how to behave amongst white supremacists and racists. Because sometimes it can cost you a job, and in some instances it could cost you your livelihood, and in some instances it costs you your life. So concealing your feelings in some situations is probably the safest option when you're dealing with racists, because racists can basically, you know, harm you in many ways. Especially if they're angry or ticked off. The topic of fanaticism, the chapter of fanaticism, basically to me sounds like racist behavior. You know, we talked about the religion of white supremacy. It's all, you know, racism is kind of like a religion. So, you know, you believe in, you know, these unverified things that, you know, racists say about, you know, non-white people. So just reminds me of racism as, you know, fanatical. But that's what I kind of got out of that. So that's all I had on me in my life.
Did we have anybody else who had commentary they wanted to get in? Did we miss somebody? Did we nab everybody? Just making sure we didn't miss anybody who had a hand up who wanted commentary to get in. All righty. Soon we got everyone. A few of the points that I highlighted from this portion of the text. I thought the quote that he had from Jonathan Swift, therefore it seemeth to me that the truest way to understand conversation is to know the faults and errors to which it is subject, and from thence every man to form maxims to himself by where it may be regulated. I thought that made great sense, especially for victims of racism, because words, deception, that's the chief tool of racist man, racist woman. So every time that we go out to participate in conversation, we have our own little set of rules, compensatory conversation control. Mr. Fuller talks about, if I'm talking to I'm talking to a white person, okay, these are things I'll be on alert for. You know, if they don't answer my question, that sort of thing. They're using metaphors, they're trying to get me to talk bad about another black person, just different things that I'll be mindful about.
that I'll do or won't do. Then if I'm talking to another victim of racism, I'm talking to another black person, I'll have different maxims, different things that I'll be mindful for in terms of how I'm talking to this person. I don't need to bring up everything that I disagree with to challenge this person. Sometimes nothing need be said, remembering that as well. But just different things to keep in mind when you, anytime that you're engaged in a conversation with other folks. Continuing the chapter, the communication panacea reminded me of Karma when he said, "I would not go so far as Oliver Goldsmith, who observed that the principal function of language is to conceal our thoughts." That was her conclusion that she shared on the program several times, many times over the years. I thought it might have been an act of racism. We had a guest on the program some years back, I think 2012, and she said one of the ways that white people practice racism is that they will repeat something racist that was said. They will find a context or a way that they can repeat it. That way they're not racist, but they still get to say whatever the racist content is that they, under any other circumstances, they couldn't say. So he talks about the busing incident, and he imagines that white people would say, "I don't want to live, eat, or do anything else with niggers." I thought that might have been an act of racism in a way for him to be able to say niggers. Next, and just him bringing up this whole incident, I thought was fascinating. Him continuing in the same portion when he says, this seems to, "As it was, the issue could be dealt with as if such hatred did not exist, and therefore a reasonable political compromise was reached." That, I thought, was another, in my view, massive act of racism. I have no idea. I mean, what do you mean a reasonable political compromise? Reasonable in whose standards? By whose standards? I'm sure if you went and talked to many of the black parents, regardless of where this happened, because he's correct, that did happen in a lot of different places at the time this book was published in the mid-1970s. I'm sure if you talked to black parents in Boston or New York, if you asked them if a reasonable political compromise was reached, their answer might be substantially different from a racist mom or dad of that period. Also, from what I know about Boston, they have archival footage that we've played on this program of white parents coming out in the middle of broad daylight in high noon on video and saying that "I am not going to school with the niggers," and they can have it. And what they did was promptly remove their children from the public schools. And they have data that that continued for generations. I don't know. Is that a reasonable political compromise that whites would just in mass remove their children from public school and have little private schools throughout Boston and other parts of the, I don't know if that's what he means by a reasonable compromise. And that's another thing that I mean in terms of the way that white people practice racism. Just any time that racism is talked about, generally they're not accurate, and they will have lots of different ways, whether it's gentrification, reasonable political compromise, lots of different ways where they are masking white terrorism. Continuing on, all on the same page, he says, "I must stress that the school problem did not arise in the first place through lack of communication. It arose because of certain historical, sociological, economic, and political facts which could not be made to disappear through the miracle of communication." Nowhere in there is the mention of white supremacy racism and racist whites saying that we do not want to educate black people, and in fact we're going to do everything in our power to obstruct them getting quality education and making that law for centuries, totally leaving that out. Again, act of racism. This is why I said sometimes it can be challenging, because these books can have great information, but it is written by often a racist white man, racist white woman. Continuing. I put an incorrect highlight down and forgot about that. Continuing the chapter on fanaticism, I thought it was interesting when he started giving his examples of the different times that you go to a political rally. And the first example that he gave was black liberation, an example of fanaticism, and that white people explicitly don't get
indicted there. But at any rate, I thought that was interesting. And I thought this was one of those times where it was significant and could be an act of racism that he mentioned Black liberation as the first example of fanaticism that you'll hear at a political rally. I also thought it was true that a lot of times you will hear the rhetoric, the metaphors and that sort of thing will be rampant at Black liberation rallies, if you want to call it that, or a lot of these other rallies, that it is true that that is something that we should be mindful of at these events, that a lot of these problems with language and what have you, it can crop up there. I just said you need to have maxims for when you're going to have conversation with a racist. Same thing if you're going to be engaged in conversation. Questions. What is this about? What are we here for? Make sure that we are set that this is supposed to be going somewhere, constructive use of time and energy, and not just a lot of gibberish, as he said before. I will stop there. Do we have any comments? Anybody have any comments they want to get in the last minute or two before we get ready to wrap things up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I found one note. I'm sorry. So the part where I was saying that on one of the revolves around the sun, it reminded me of when Jimmy Fuller said, my history is everything that can be more. And it's kind of, I'm reminded it's not to dismiss history, and it's not to dismiss, you know, science, what, you know, whether or not the earth is revolving, the earth is revolving around the sun, but it's not to dismiss it, but to instead focus on the situation that you're currently involved in. And I thought that was a good example. I thought that was actually the takeaway from, I think, fanaticism, but yeah.
Our narrator, Mel, being able to find some of her notes from the earlier portion of the reading. Thank you again for pitching in, doing a great job with the reading, even when she was not feeling 100%. Spectacular effort. Much obliged for Cal's listeners. I'm sure they appreciate as well, and particularly because this is a book that a lot of folks might have not have access to. This is an out-of-print text. If you are close to a major university library, you can probably get it, but it's not one that you can just easily go into, you know, Borders, Amazon, and oh yeah, they'll have it right there that you can go sit down and read on the spot. So I hope people are enjoying it. I hope it has some constructive information. I think so, even though it is written by a suspected racist. We'll pick up there next week, continuing. You can drop an email if you have a thought, observation. We can read it as we go. We should have a few more weeks of reading to continue with the text. We'll be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on news, observations from the past 7 days. Dial in, share a thought or two. Dr. Niana Rasayan, he'll be with us this coming Tuesday. Pam was supposed to be with us on Wednesday, and she was not in good health. She was feeling terrible, and we had to reschedule. I think when she was supposed to be on towards the end of the summer, I was not feeling well, and now I am better, and she is not doing well. So hopefully everybody will be feeling great coming soon, and we can have her on the program. But we did miss our program with her on this past Wednesday. We'll be rescheduling, but Dr. Niana Rasayan this coming Tuesday will be with us. We'll review the Las Vegas shooting and some of the other more recent happenings. Thanks everyone for participating. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. I hope you are enjoying the read. Man, crazy talk, stupid talk. I'm glad we are revisiting Neil Postman's work. Maybe we should check out Amusing Ourselves to Death. I read that book with this one. I thought that one was also very interesting. That one is not as much about language use. It's more about just getting distracted with like entertainment and such, and how that can lead you from being logical and the impact of television. That's more of what that's about. Although he does talk quite a bit about language as well, but interesting. That one is much more popular. That was a big time bestseller. That one is still in print. You can go to the bookstore and easily get a copy of that one. So if you are enjoying this, you might want to check that one out, that out as well. That's it. Before I even get to that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I know it is the weekend and folks might be going out to, you know, do whatever.
Just keep that in mind. We are still in the context of white supremacy, and there is a lot of evidence that whites, they take advantage of non-white people, black people who are not thinking correctly, are a little bit intoxicated. They love to swoop in and make more problems for us that could be easily avoided if we were sober. If you are going to be out and about in a vehicle, definitely want to make sure you are sober and buckled up. That is for passengers and pedestrians. You never know when you could be out and about and bump into a Daniel Holtzclaw. You might have to make some life-saving decisions. Might be better to be sober at that moment. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all. We're tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.